This is HPR episode 2830 entitled, HPR NYE Show 2018-2019 Part 1. It is hosted by Honky Magoo and is about 203 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, the HPR community comes together to say Happy New Year and chat.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by Archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
T-minus 11 minutes. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, in exactly 1 minute, the island of Samoa and Christmas Islands will be celebrating their 2019 New Year's celebration. And you have joined us for the 7th annual HPR New Year's show, a 24 to 26 hour extravaganza, because of time zones, organized this year again by Honky Magoo and Kay Wisher. So let's do the first countdown. Join me, folks. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Happy 2019 for some people. And the next one to go is the Chapman Islands in New Zealand. So, for those of you who are new to HPR, HPR is a community podcast network where the shows are contributed by listeners like you. The HPR New Year show was put, well, actually, a little bit of history that's been not being so official about it and all, because the majority of podcasters who are in free and open source podcasting are also hosts on HPR. It seems like a natural place where HPR would get together and have a mumble chat and basically talk about the year and wish, you know, it's one time of the year where everybody can come on and say hello. And if you don't hear it on the day, then you your greetings will be passed onto the HPR feed, which people listen to. It started off as a 7 years ago. As a evening show, and then pretty much we decided to make it a 24-hour show, and then we discovered that actually there were 26 time zones in a particular day due to the weirdnesses of time zones. Don't get me started on that one. For example, the Chapman Islands, New Zealand, has a 15-minute offset, so in 30 minutes they will be celebrating their New Year. Well, anyway, Kay Wisher and Honky Magoo from the Linux Lowcast. Those guys have live streams every month, so they were kind enough to offer their assistance and Etherpad and stuff to basically put on the show. So that's pretty much it. Because it's a Monday, last year there was quite a lot of people on at this time because people had it the day free, but because it's Monday and not a bank holiday as such until tomorrow, I don't expect it to be too busy today. So I will be here pottering about in the lab. No soldering this year, I'm afraid, in my bill. He will be thankful of that because my soldering efforts last year ended up costing him a few thousand in the purchase of a microscope. However, this year I intend to do some scanning and archiving of my father-in-law's photos, so we can enjoy that experience as we go along. If you're listening to this, it's after the fact. We're not rushing out the shows either. Honky is going to edit them, I believe, and you'll probably hear this around March. So, all the best. So basically, I'll just stay here pottering around, and due to the wonders of truncate silence, this will be, all the empty spaces will be truncated now for your listening pleasure. Top of the morning, Tier 50. I'm going to have to hand back my Irish street cred for saying that statement.
I guess it helps if I turn the headphones on. So I assume this is going on the stream. 5150, I usually try to drop in for the first few minutes. Saw Ken in the room, but I don't think he was listening, and he just dropped out. The mic should be working. I'm not sure if receiving is working, but since nobody's talking, I figured it is. What I'll probably do is switch over to, you know, I just got up a little early to check stuff out, and I'll probably monitor while I have breakfast and stuff on the speakers, and but I'll be back in later today when there are folks here. So just Happy New Year's, everybody, and welcome to the Hacker Public Radio New Year's celebration. I'm sure probably, you know, Ken said something like that when he first came on, and now Ken's back. Ken, do you hear me?
Yes, I do. Can you hold on one sec? Can you also press record, please?
I'm not recording.
Do you have an ability to set up a recording?
Oh, yeah, that's definitely.
Yeah, because this thing just crashed. I can hear you fine. I switched to Bluetooth headset so I can walk around. Okay, I see you're recording.
Well, I clicked start. It doesn't seem to have started anything. Just a second.
Yeah, it said you were. So.
Yeah, the counter's going, so I guess I did.
Honky's Etherpad has just crashed. So we keep track of the show notes on the Etherpad instance.
Right.
Which has just seemed to crash now. Can you get to it?
Let me look.
And in 30 seconds, the Chapman Islands and New Zealand will be heading off, leaving this world and going to the next. And Happy New Year to the Chapman Islands and New Zealand.
Gee, where's Claw 2? This should be his time to come on.
Yes, exactly. Well, he has a life, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, at least one of us has one.
So the next one that's coming up will be New Zealand again, with exceptions and more. Auckland Island. Actually, no, he won't be up for another hour. So it's going to be fun discussions about counting down time zones again. Oh, well. It's a tradition now. Do you not have to work today?
Well, I'm self-employed. I'm going to be in and out all day. I've got errands I have to do in town, end of the year stuff, and that I should have taken care of and didn't.
Yeah. I know the story. We got company days off for today and Wednesday, which was excellent news. I didn't realize it, so I got that pleasant surprise last week.
Well, glad to hear it.
Yeah, so I'm going to... I got a box of photos to archive for my father-in-law, so I'm going to go see if I can sort that out, seeing as I'm going to be here in the back room anyway.
Well, that sounds like a good activity. I've got one friend who's off from his two jobs that he's been assigned to for 2 years. In other words, he's manager of two offices, getting paid for being one, and he works for the U.S. government, so he's off completely right now.
Yeah. Yeah, bit of a bummer, that.
I'm about 24 hours in, or a little more than that, with a new ISP.
How does that, what sort, DSL or cable or?
No, it's actually over the cell network, I'm blacking, but the high speed, whatever it is.
Yeah, cool. It doesn't seem too bad.
It's not as fast. It's faster than what I had a little bit. It's not and more consistent. The old one, I was always having to, you know, sometimes as often as every 24 hours, unplug the uplink and plug it back in to get anywhere near the bandwidth. And this is consistently faster, and, you know, and stable, but it's not getting the speed. The advertised speed was supposed to be 23 megabits down, which seems really fast for cell network, but I did I did see it running on a friend's rural system. I don't know, they showed me on the phone. Maybe they gave him an app that lied to him. But the other thing my friend did was they too at first didn't have the speeds that were advertised, and they had to go back to Amazon and buy extra antennas to plug into this to the cellular modem, and that seemed to fix it. So I was hoping not, you know, I was hoping to get away without it, because I'm, you know, the side that I have, that it, you know, where I have windows on, I'm in a berm house, for those people Didn't know.
And what's a burn house for those of you who haven't followed your very tragic events?
Well, I know, very tragic, but I've got cement and dirt on two sides. In other words, it's built into the hillside. Now, it's not completely covered up, which is one of the things I had been thinking. And then I had talked to a friend of my dad, said, no, we had a house like that. And we couldn't, you know, they pulled dirt in over the top of the roof, and they said they couldn't keep it from leaking.
Oh, yeah, good advice. So how was that working out for you?
Very well. I enjoyed it. I like the house. I like the location. Everybody, you know, it's on the side of a lake. So the first thing anybody says when they visit me is how much they like the view. But like I said,
Carry on. I interrupted you. Go.
Cell tap. There's a cell emitter on top of the grain elevator less than a mile to south. And I thought maybe I'd get a buy without the booster antennas. But looks like I'd have to have them. So, we'll see. When I will do an HPR on it sometime when, you know, once I get everything worked out, because there was another provider using a cellular modem, and their highest available speed is actually a little faster than what I'm getting right now. So, if this is a total bust, I will probably drop these people and go to them, because I don't. One nice thing about the contractor is no, you know, initial period that you have to stick with them. Stuck with the equipment, though, get a SIM card and reuse the modem.
Good stuff.
I looked, and the modem they sent me, you know, they charged me $150. That would be with the SIM card set up, all that. And the modem retails on Amazon, that model, for $110. So I didn't think I got hurt too bad. The setup fee is $150, but that includes $100 for the first month. So really, I don't, you know, unless they're just taking my credit card and ripping me off or something. I think it's a pretty good deal so far. I mean, if it doesn't work, I can go with the other provider. So now it's going to be next year. The $100 a month is the initial thing. They get you the next year. It's like $139. But like I said, the next highest I could get was like six down. If I can actually get 23 or any significant part of that, it's worth the extra money. Because the one other place I was looking at, they were going to be 80. So not that much difference.
It's still rather expensive, but I suppose if you are living out in the country, you don't have that much in the way of choice.
Well, that's what I was going to broadcast. You know, like I said, anybody wants to look into it, and once I see if I can, you know, where it maxes out, I'll do an episode, because I do know there's people on the network. I'm thinking of Lost in Bronx in particular. No, he doesn't have a whole lot of extra resources, but you know, this could be the solution people are looking for, because this, you know, really the theoretical download speeds they're advertised is about what I was getting when I was on cable living in town.
Yeah, but it all depends on how many other people are on at any given time as well, so yeah. It's a shared pipe, so yeah.
Right. So we'll see how it goes. I see Honky's joined us.
Top of the morning to you. Oh, never gets old. Still sorting out his issues, I imagine.
Yeah, the one thing I've been telling people, never mention the name of the hosting company. It's blazinghog.com, just one G in hog. And if you look that up, you know, if you look up Blazing Hog on the internet or on Google, you're going to get a bunch of barbecue places. So just go to blazinghog.com. And like I said, I'm not vouching for him yet, because I'm not getting the speed I'm supposed to. So maybe wait till you hear me do an HPR or on another venue say I've got it fixed.
Running into a problem here now. My push to talk key is all caps, and now I'm locked in all caps. Yeah, right, not good. Okay, Honky's recording as well. That's excellent. Honky, if you're listening, I think I may have crashed the Etherpad.
No, I'm on the Etherpad.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I know you sent me out to check that, and then I got lost in my own story and forgot to tell you. No, it works for me.
I'm just going to nip to the front room to get some film holders to find them. Any idea how to uncap when you're capped?
That's a good question. I usually use one of the control keys as push to talk, so it doesn't really affect anything, not in combination with anything else. I mean, I know there are people who go in and just disable caps lock as, you know, having anything to do with the keyboard in the first place, figuring they just hold down shift if they need caps lock. It's an anachronism to typewriters.
Yeah, I do the same thing myself, but the problem is now that my cap lock is... I'm running LXQT, and there's no easy way to do that, so you have to use XSet keyboard map settings, and it doesn't completely disable it because it's still acting as a control key for scrolling.
Okay, yeah, I'm using the LXQT myself right now. Not that so, relevant to anything. Never had to solve that particular issue.
Yeah, I just wanted to disable it. It's all going to the Arch Wiki, of course.
Yep, there's very few things that you can... Doesn't matter... Well, we're just discussing that on the last Linux Slugcast, but... Doesn't matter what distribution you run, there's very few things that aren't there in the Arch Wiki.
That's true. Yeah, found it.
Well, you get to work, you need to share off the class then.
Yeah, I will. Okay, that disabled it. Now I just look again when it's lowercase. And I was able to get that as ArchWiki keyboard layout config, which I'll paste into the show notes.
You can see them now then?
Yeah, I can, yeah.
That's one thing I'm working on right now is trying to change my time display to UTC so that for the rest of the day I can coordinate with the show notes.
I think you can add an extra clock down and then just tick on the extra clock in your taskbar and just set it to be UTC, what I tend to do.
Yeah, I'm in world clock settings right now, and I've added UTC, but I haven't seen yet how to change it.
Oh, I mean on the taskbar at the bottom, on LXQT?
Yes.
So if you go configuration time.
Okay, that's probably it.
It says use UTC third option down, show seconds 12-hour style are used, and of course the date format you can select as ISO 8601, the only same date format.
Right, I have to do what you do, but I usually use military, which is date, month, year, instead of leading with the year, just because that's what people are used to over here. If you start now, if I label a file, I do year, month, date. Writing a date on a check or something like that.
I know you have to conform. Much though it pains me, yes, you do have to conform. Okay, cool. Back in a bit.
All right.
I'm back.
Welcome back.
So what time is it there?
4:39 a.m.
Is this normal that you're up feeding the cows or what?
Oh, sometimes I get weird and out of whack. This is one of those days. And, you know, I usually do like to drop in on at least the first hour of the... of the New Year's Eve broadcast. I'm past the point where I can sit here and do 26 hours in a row and stay up. Working. So my plan was to hang on for a while and then probably, you know, fix a little breakfast, go back to bed for a couple hours, get back up, get some of my stuff done. So I'll be monitoring throughout the day. I know the Tilts guys had talked about jumping in noon their time, which would be Eastern Standard Time. So I figured I would jump in with them for a while, but so then I got to go to town and get my stuff done in town. And after that, I should be able to hang out the rest of the evening.
Cool. I intend to just be pottering here all day, and then just as you're kind of coming online, I'll be just having some family time, and then the new year I'll drop in to say hi, and then I'll pick it up again in the morning.
Yeah, that's probably the plan, is to, you know, probably stay up kind of late, get a few hours sleep, get back up before the end. Did finally figure out my trouble setting UTC, and I'm actually looking at two clocks. I'm running Nixus OS, which is a version of Ubuntu, and finally I said, you know, maybe it was hanging up my Firefox. I don't think that was it, but I installed LXQT.
How are you finding LXQT?
I enjoy it. Welcome, Foki.
Hello, Foki.
Hi. I will only be a court owl. I'm on the train to Stockholm.
That's what that sound is. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Using Plumble, I imagine?
Yes. HPR New Year's show. My wife is giving me a strange look. She doesn't know what I'm doing here.
I have had 7 years of those strange looks, I must say. Fine, leave them off. It's one day. Okay. So what's in Stockholm?
We will be on a ship, which is now a youth hostel. Its name is Alf Chapman. So we will have a good time, 3 days with the family, going to all museums we we can.
So where are you living in Germany, I think? Where do you live? Are you in Sweden all the time?
I'm from Germany, but we live in Sweden.
Ah, the pin drops. Whereabouts?
You know, I don't think the line is holding.
Okay,
I shall speak to you another time.
Okay, have a happy New Year.
Bye-bye. Yeah?
Yes, asking too many questions there. The old I'm going through a tunnel thing.
Well, it looks like Hockey is with us twice now. Can either one of them hear us, though, is the question.
Yes, I can hear and speak. I woke up late. I woke up about 5:11. I rushed downstairs, turned on the machine, turned on Mumble, turned on recording. I am now in the car on my way to work. No shower, but I have coffee and bagels.
Well, let's...
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
That doesn't sound fun, having to go to work that early.
Yeah, I have inventory today, so I get to spend my day counting.
Yeah, still a bit beats the normal day, I guess. Change is as good as a rest.
And, you know, I don't have to explain this to you, Honky or Ken, but anybody listening wonder why we do this. It's just, it's the one day a year we connect, I guess face-to-face isn't the right word, but at least voice-to-voice with all our friends in the community.
Right, and it's also... I think it's an easy way for people to kind of break that, what I like, third wall. Well, it's not what I call it, but it's definitely a third wall between the podcaster and the podcast listener, because that's kind of how I did it. I mean, it was one of the New Year's shows. I came on and I just started talking a little bit, and that broke the third wall for me, and that kind of spurred me on to actually trying to, you know, do podcasting.
Wow, I'm impressed. That is actually cool. And thank you very much for doing the organization with Kevin on this. It's made is a lot more chilled out here in our household as a result of that.
Well, this year Kevin did like 90% of it. I set up something up on the page, but I mean, and I'm not doing the hosting the Etherpad for the show notes, but Kevin did a lot of it this year. I mean, I have no problem doing the show editing. I enjoy doing the show editing. That's fine with me. I just, it's...
You're mad.
Kind
You're
of mad. Rushing. Why you just kind of choose a time, amount of time, or how many chunks you want to take that giant thing of, what, 20, however many hours that you usually wind up getting of actual audio after you do truncate silence, and then, kind of trying to find the right place that you can kind of cut it and then throwing in the show notes for that section. I mean, I'm gonna have to sit down and listen to all of it just so I can make sure that the show notes line up, but that's about the only hard part.
Yeah, I used to do the editing, and for some reason I had the idea of getting it out as quickly as possible, but yeah, what's the point? So,
and that was madness. But you did it. We're proud.
Yeah, but, you know, it didn't matter. It was actually no harm getting the shows later on, and then, oh yeah, that was New Year, and that was the conversation that was going on then. Yeah, it's timeless. Just chill out, really, was the lesson that I learned for the New Year show.
Well, also, I think more people listen if you do, okay, here's a New Year's show, and then we got regular content, and a week or two later, here's the next section of the New Year's show, right? You know, because there's going to be some people say, oh, yeah, it's going to be a New Year's show for the first for the next week. I can't make that kind of time commitment, and they skip the whole thing.
Yep. 26 hours is a lot of shows.
Yeah, minimum 26. Well, I don't know. This year where we've got, we're doing okay so far, but, you know, where it's a work day and stuff, I'm sure there's going to be a little bit of dead air in there.
Oh, yeah, I'm expecting it to be quiet. But, you know, if people pop on, then there's somebody here to talk to them, so good.
That's actually something I wanted to talk to you about. Did you want us to do, like, last year I sent it all to you at once, and then you kind of sprinkled it in throughout the year. If you're going to do it that way, I can just kind of upload it to you as soon as I get, like, episode one done. I can upload it to you, and then you can put it in whatever. Or we can try to do something where it's I get it all done, and we do it, like, maybe once a week or once every other week, where it's kind of like Hookah had set up for some of the series, where every Friday was something on LibreOffice.
Well, when you have the first one done, post it. And on the post and show page, it tells you, it advises that if you're doing a series, which this would be, that you do it every 2 weeks. But this is so different, I'll leave it up to you. I mean, I have no more say than anyone else. Just you pick your slot and then put it in. The reason I spaced it out last year was I think there was other shows in between. So I filled in the gaps.
Okay, I want to confirm with you, not like I couldn't do this myself, probably. What do you have for UTC right now? Because for some reason, to get my clock to line up with the show notes, I had to do like UTC plus one. Oh, maybe that's daylight. No, it's regular time.
So right now I have 10:51. Yeah, that'd be about right. Well, 10:52, but yeah, 10 o'clock.
Okay, good. Well, that throws me off somehow because it shows the next time zone on in the show notes after you've typed to be 12 o'clock UTC.
Yes. Oh, yeah, we're all off.
Okay. Yeah, okay. My first post, I probably jumped one.
No, it was probably me. So where are we now? 11:52. No, I think we're right. No, we're not. I'll move it around.
Okay, you move yours, and when you get it done, I'll move mine.
Yeah, done.
Okay, well, I'm glad I said something, not to be critical, but Honky would be scratching his head in about a week trying to edit it now, if we hadn't figured that out.
Oh, absolutely.
No, and Honky knows this from listening to Linux Ludcast, but when I installed LXQT over the default stuff for the Nitrix OS, I still have the Nitrix top bar and dock and all that kind of stuff. So eventually I'll have to get rid of that for efficiency. But right now I've got two clocks, one my time and one UTC. So I'll probably leave it like that for a while.
Sorry, we're struggling to get photos onto the scanner. So we should be going to the next 4 minutes. The main New Zealand will be going. That should be enough time to get a coffee, what do you reckon?
So, Honk, did you get the chance to see the Orville?
Not yet. I'll probably get... no, wait a minute. It doesn't come out yet. It's January 4th, isn't it?
No, it was last night. It was on Hulu at 2 o'clock, my time.
Oh, I'll check it out. Oh, that's right. It was the 30th. I even put that on the Mattermost for X101.
Well, I'm pretty sure X101 knows when it starts. Well, shoot, I was going to talk about it, but we don't want to have spoilers.
I usually don't watch anything live, and then last night was just, I don't know, I didn't even think about it last night. But I'll probably watch it in like another day or so.
Yeah, I usually watch it. Well, I very rarely watch anything on live TV. I need to get taller antenna up so I can get all the channels anyway. But even so, if it's something I can get later on a streaming service that I'm paying for, it's just easier. You know, I've said before, you know, I don't want to. Yeah, we have the technology now, so I don't want to have to be my tail is in the chair at this hour, at this time, to be able to consume consume what I want to watch.
The only thing I watch live is football.
It's amazing how little TV I watch now. Mostly switched to YouTube videos.
Yeah, my trouble is, and I probably ought to kill one of my streaming services. Maybe I will kill Netflix once they lose all of the Marvel content. There's a lot of good stuff there, but it's just, there's way more stuff that I could possibly sit down and watch in my lifetime. And, even if that's all I did the rest of my life, 8 hours a day, or 16 or whatever, watch TV, I think between YouTube and Netflix and Hulu and DC coming out and Disney coming out and Marvel coming out, there's going to be more stuff than I could possibly have the time to watch. And then, somebody would say, well, you need to cut one of those services, but there's that one thing I want to see, or not one thing, but these things I definitely want to watch on that service.
Yeah, that's where you get you. Happy New Year to New Zealand. I just cancelled my Netflix subscription because I realized the kids were watching the same thing, so I ordered them on DVD, and it's just cheaper. After a month, I actually own the thing that's on the NAS. And the real reason was because, they changed the UI, so it starts playing previews, and there was no way to turn it off.
I haven't seen that yet.
Okay, well, they have it over here, so you turn on the TV, and instead of, there being a screenshot of recommended stuff, so I go in on my profile, which is an adult profile, and then suddenly there's, around Halloween time, there was all this horror and stuff automatically playing on the screen as my kids are sitting around there, and I was extremely not happy with that. So I contacted them and explained the situation, and within a millisecond, they were able to give me a two-page, answer. Basically, it's a lot of people find it annoying, but basically there's nothing you can do about it. So I said, okay then, is there anything else you want me to do? I said, yes, you can tell me how to close your account. May I ask why you want to close your account? Have you not been paying attention? So, that's that. It's actually, I asked the kids what they were watching, and then it was just easier to order it on Amazon and get the DVD shit.
Well, the friend I mentioned earlier, he's back on Dish now, but I mean, he was off for 6 months because, I can't remember the problem. He wasn't getting connected or whatever or something. And, and he called him once, was on the phone for a while, then it didn't get resolved. And, called him back and a month later or whatever. They said, we'll credit you going forward. And he says, well, yeah, but I called a month ago. And he's like, they're like, no, you didn't. We've got no record of your call. I mean, that's not what you tell a customer.
That's not good. That's not good. No.
I mean, even if you think the customer is scamming you or something, it's not worth a month or whatever to call the customer a liar to their face, because they're going to go.
Yeah. The thing about it is, especially with streaming services or subscription services, it's in your best interest to move around, because a customer who stays is not a problem. But if you disconnect, then you can come in, you can get the new discounts. So if you're just willing to go to another service for 6 months, then you wait for the new discounts on this, and you come in as yet a new customer on the new services.
Right. That always makes me mad when, I get a thing in my email. Oh, yeah, we've got this discount. Then you click on it, and it's like new customers only. And it's like, so me being a customer for 5 years doesn't count for anything with you.
Yeah, and unless people do that, unless people churn, then they're going to see that, there's no incentive for anybody, because they know that people who don't churn are just going to give them, they're going to continue giving them the subscription money. So there is no reason to invest any time and effort in it. Just think about it logically. Like, if you're, regardless how bad a service you give to somebody, and if they continue paying you, well, the bottom line is you're still getting money from the people. So why would you put any money into them? So always, it's a pain in the ass, yes, but always switch providers every few years and make sure, if I don't get the discount, I'm disconnecting. And a good trick some people do here is they especially if they're not married, or you know, they don't have a contract, a married contract, in the sense that they have they're married but they have separate, maintaining their separate identities. They will cancel the subscription, and then the partner or wife will or husband or whoever will then, under their name, will call up and go, "Hey, I'm a new customer in this house. I want service."
Right. Yeah, that's a pretty good trick to do if you can do it.
And that's the point. If you can do it, if you're willing to put up with the thing. So, yeah, get 6 months of Netflix, binge out and everything, and then cancel it and watch the rest of the stuff. Because, I mean, hey, do you really need it for the whole year? You'll go to switch to Amazon or Google or something. At least you have choices, you know?
Well, right. I mean, and last year I was not going to watch Discovery, you know, because it was the one, you know, only thing on the service. And maybe if they do Picard or whatever and branch out, then maybe I, you know, and I hate to do another service, but, you know, maybe that might be worth it. It's more than one show. And then people were talking about it online on stuff I heard and said it was getting better. So finally I went in, and I think I was in there for about 2 months. But I, you know, that's the way I did it. I got in there, watched the one show I wanted to watch, and then canceled again.
Yeah, but if you're saying that it is, see, Hunky Magoo, I wonder, am I allowed to truncate it down to Hunk?
Oh yeah. We call him Honky all the time. Unfortunately, I think he just got to work, so he dropped off on the phone.
But so 20, I don't know what it costs over there for a month of Netflix. It's 14 euros here. So 2 months, that's 28 euros. Could you buy the series on DVD for that?
Well, it's like 7 here. And like I said, I don't, I'm going to have some decision to make when they do Marvel, because years ago, I did Netflix for a while, and then I looked at it and said, well, the only new movie, you know, if they had a whole bunch of old cowboy movies, and I still don't know a good place to get those. Then I would have stuck with them. But old war movies, whatever. Something they could get cheap. You would think they could get them cheap. But you know, the only first run movies they had back in the day, and they're not much better now, is that they get all the horror movies. And, you know, okay, but I can't just sit there and watch horror movie after horror movie, you know. So, you know, a few of the big stuff they get, and like I said, most of it's Marvel, which they're not going to get anymore. And once the Marvel series are done, yeah, that was not Marvel pulling it away from Netflix. Netflix paid buku about money for those licenses, and they said, well, we've got all our independent stuff now, we don't need Marvel anymore. So I think that may be a big mistake for them. Maybe they could have negotiated a better price, but I if those are your huge franchises, I can't see stabbing a knife into them. But it, especially since they're not going to come yeah, I think they're produced by CBS or somebody. Everybody says, no, there's no way they're moving to the new Marvel network. They're not coming back. I am very disappointed with Netflix for that action. And so I don't really have a good feeling towards them right now. And like I said, once the last of the original Marvel series airs, I'm going to have a decision to make whether I want to keep Netflix.
Yeah, I think a little bit of history or context here is interesting in what happened with Netflix, because they were a DVD company, and essentially that was going nowhere. And the cable companies in the US were basically screwing the content providers for they were able to collectively, I won't say it's a monopoly or a cartel, but they were able to collectively agree what the prices were for the content providers, yeah? So they were basically setting the price, and the content providers weren't overly happy with that. But there was no other alternative. So what they did was they gave Netflix for something like 2 or 4 years rights to basically lots of stuff for cheap, for real, real cheap, a lot cheaper than anybody could ever get it. And then that made Netflix a very big player. And then Netflix were doing the same thing. They could demand the price from the content providers because they had the outlets that everybody had. And to respond, then Hulu and Disney and whoever are now setting up. So problem now is you've got one series that you want to watch on one service, and that means a subscription, and you can't get it any other way. So, yeah, there you are.
Yeah, I'll be surprised within 5 years that we don't have some sort of packaging thing like cable where, you know, you pay one price and you get Disney and Marvel or what. Well, maybe they would never work together, but, you know, get some kind of roll in some kind of discount, because, yeah, I think a lot of people are not going to say, yeah, I'm going to pay $15 for each channel. Oh, I don't think I ever answered your earlier question. I believe Netflix is like $8 now.
Yeah, I don't. I was very disappointed comparing the content that was on Netflix and now the licensing here. They didn't have the same freedom here. Basically, the stuff that they have here is just terrible. And, you know, there was a time when I remember hearing you guys talking about it, that everything was on Netflix. But here, you type in something and you immediately get a response back, oh, something like this movie that you want to watch brought up these other titles. It's just, yeah, frustrating. There was nothing on there for me, to be honest. I'm not into any of the Marvel movies, because in the last 10 years, I've said it before and I'll say it again, the CGI, just as soon as I see it, I'm out of the movie. I just can't, I can't watch it. And I can't invest the time into that number of series. I don't have that amount of free time.
Well, that's interesting. Now, the one thing I've always, you know, said, why DC has never tried Green Lantern again, is the CGI just isn't up to it. I mean, I guess if you want to watch Green Lantern, you're going to have a certain disconnect. I didn't think the old movie was horrible myself, but definitely, you know, you combine live action with, you know, Green Lantern type stuff, it's gonna come out looking like a cartoon even now.
Yeah, no, to me, it's just looks like a video game. Everything there's a YouTube series I watch called let me through the wonders of truncate silence, I'll be able to bring it up for you.
Well, you're looking for, instance, you know, one of my favorite things on YouTube is all the history stuff. And there's almost nothing probably you can't find if you wanted to look for all these history channels. And a lot of it, you know, what I watch tends towards maybe military type history, but certainly not all yeah. of it.
I've just finished watching the entire series of The Great War. Absolutely monumental work.
Oh yeah, that should be a college course. You know, you just go
yeah,
in
absolutely.
And watch.
Yeah, go ahead over.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't catch it. Well, I didn't know about it at the beginning, maybe the first 2 years. I wish I did, and I didn't catch, because of that, I didn't catch every single episode all the way through. But I mean, yeah, if you want to do a college course on World War One, I don't see how you could do better than just, you know, bring the people in, darken the room, do that, you know, do that episode. Of course, I guess it'd be a 5-year college course.
Oh yeah, but I mean, it is. It's just it is just such an excellent series. It reminds me of the quality of the BBC World of War episode, World War series, which is about World War II. And even my entire interest with World War I history, in talking to people and talking to also veterans and stuff at the time, not at the time, afterwards, but my entire perceptions of that whole war, why it was started, everything just completely changed, and how inevitable World War II became as a result.
Right. I mean, you know, I would definitely compare the Great War series with anything Dan Carlin has done, maybe even better, certainly a lot more detailed than he has time to devote to it. I mean, it just blown away. You know, like I said, it if you could have had the TV news that we do today, you know, following the war, and if you didn't have a bunch of censorship and all that by the government's involved, you know, this if you've never watched it, imagine that. If you were in 1915 watching the quality of today's news reports explaining what happened that day.
I disagree. There's no way you're getting an accurate picture in any of the news reports. And I'll tell you why. During the Troubles in the North, right? And you see this every 30 years, they release the Official Secrets, Act expires on content. And you see that news reports coming out during the time were covering stuff up, were not reporting stuff, were reporting stuff deliberately and accurately on both sides in order to influence what the information that the people had and also the participants at the time. So if you assume that that's continuing on, because that was going on at the time of World War One as well, you have to assume that the news today is being reported exactly the same way. There is, no matter what we do, we're not getting the big picture, and you won't get the big picture until 30 years from now. So
no, that was just sort of a kind of, but like I said, yeah, I did say without censorship, but there's a lot of stuff, you know, nobody would know about until somebody writes a book or a memoir or, you know, something.
Yeah, but also you don't know if a battle is important or not. He will say, oh, this was important because it was the first time this was used, but, you know, first time a flamethrower was used, but sometimes things happened and they didn't turn out to be important. So it's actually even better than the news you get today because you know what's important in relation to this will have a consequence. Sorry, you will be, yeah, if you know what I mean. Sorry, am I making myself clear?
Oh, yeah, I understand. Another one I like is the ones that come out of the Tank Museum in Britain. The
Imperial War Museum?
That yes, one? and they coordinate with, the Great War and Forgotten Weapons, and another one of my favorite channels, and we won't go so far into that. Maybe when the Tilts guys come on, because it's, you know, that's a guns discussion, and probably not appropriate this early in the morning.
For some reason, you're under the opinion that I have a difference of opinion with you on the use of guns and who should have them. I do find that the Forgotten Weapons thing, they did a joint series with, was it them that did the joint series with the Great War, where they went through the weapons and uniforms of the different armies and fired off the weapons. Extremely interesting.
Yes, and occasionally, when he's got, you know, when they have the funding, they'll actually visit First and Second World War sites, mostly First World War, and explain why those were important.
What I've really found interesting with those weapons shows was after the war. After the First World War, the Irish government had a lot of the British weapons. You know, they got them over when we got independence. They got the garrisons and they got the weapons from the British Army. So when I was when I joined the volunteer reserves when I was a lad, they still had some of those weapons around, and we got to shoot the, you know, World War One and World War Two weapons that were used by the Allies during the war. Pretty cool.
Well, I've made at least one purchase, tried others. You know, things went higher than I was willing to spend, but I do have an old Colt that is period. You know, we've talked about me doing a show on my reproductions that I've collected, and the last one that I was looking at pretty high, you know, and I was thinking, you know, at this level, I can actually go get the real thing, and I actually do. And we've talked about this, that was okay, but there, you know, that may be my first HPR on weapons, my actual 100-year-old Colt.
Yeah, cool. I would be interested in hearing that. God, that didn't take long, folks, did it, to get to the old weapons, did it? But the YouTube video series I was looking at was History Buffs, where he takes a video and will say how accurate it is to the time. And so, like, he did Gettysburg, he reckoned was a brilliant movie. And Toro, Toro, Toro. Do you ever watch that? Did you ever see that?
Oh, yeah. I've got that on DVD. You know, my dad was a big Western buff, and the next thing after that was war movies. So, you know, that was one of the first things I started after the fire was to rebuild the collection.
It's so frustrating when you when your stuff gets burned. It happened to me as well. I left my collections with people, and they, for some reason, burnt them without contacting. Not that I'm bitter. Yes, and the reason I was thinking of that YouTube series, Toro, 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 he reckons that is one of the most accurate movies that he's seen, was that Pearl Harbor wasn't, and they relied there on CGI. And ever since then, I've been looking for CGI.
Good morning.
Good morning, Buckwheat.
Good morning. We're getting a lot of feedback. Go figure yourself to put to talk, please.
Well, Tor.
Okay, I'm going to have to mute you because it's completely unintelligible. Yep.
Tor,
very nice welcome. You're welcome, obviously.
Yeah, anybody coming on, just push to talk is the way to go. That means when you're going to talk, you push a button. There are settings in Mumble for a level when the level coming from
push to talk here today. The only thing that you can do with so many people on is push to talk.
I think you're right, because anybody has any background noise or anything like that, you know, even with their best efforts, it just never works. No, and I'm sure you know this, Ken. You know, the whole thing about Tor, 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 they had two directors. They had a separate director for all the Japanese-oriented part of the movie, and then another one for the American-oriented part.
It was, I didn't know that, no. Fascinating. It was very fair, I thought, or appeared to be fair.
Right, and this may be a controversial opinion. The main thing I have against the Japanese is that it was a sneak attack. I mean, the United States clearly picked sides in the war between Japan and China, and we're sending supplies to one side and we embargoed the other. And I think under the Geneva Convention, General Rules of War, you know, the Japanese probably had a point saying, hey, you know, this is, you're not being a neutral party, and if you continue these policies past a certain point, you know, we have no choice but to declare war. But of course, you know, the only way they could have succeeded at Pearl Harbor was a sneak attack. So that's the way they went. And the Japanese are already doing bad things, but I mean, as far as grievances against the United States, that's the one thing that I would, the sneak attack is what I would point out. If I probably wouldn't have a problem with them if they'd said, you know, look, you're not playing fair, and, we're not going to be able to tolerate it past a certain point.
Yeah, but, you have to admit that statement that you just made is coming with a lot of American baggage. So whether it's correct or not, I can understand if other people would have a different opinion.
No, I certainly understand that. I mean, you know,
I don't know enough about either side to be able to comment. And as I said, after watching the Great War, the reasons that I had understood the Great War had occurred just were blown out of the water, because it was... it couldn't possibly have been that. So, however, well, the facts are there was a sneak attack of the Pearl Harbor base, and it did bring the U.S. into the war. And the question is why there were so few aircraft carriers there at the time would be an interesting question.
Well, I've seen different analysis on that. Yamamoto, you know, really wasn't interested in getting the aircraft carriers. He didn't think they were important. They did have a junior officer under him saying, yeah, we really need to get the aircraft carriers too. So it was a compromise, you know, that Yamamoto didn't even want to target the aircraft carriers. Of course, they weren't there, so the point was moot. I don't know who did it. There was a real good explanation, you know, on YouTube I saw the other day, that because the carriers weren't there and things weren't where the Japanese thought they were supposed to be, that the attack was really not as successful as it could have been, because you had a bunch of guys, targets weren't there, they had to fly around, and the only avenue down was really down this one slot where, you know, since everybody's flying in from the same way, they were pretty good targets. Of course, the Japanese, I almost said Japs there, sorry, did not lose that many aircraft compared to the damage that they did. But, you know, definitely, I think if they'd sunk the carriers, I think with the industrial mind of the United States, being from the U.S., you know, I think the outcome was inevitable either way, but definitely that made a huge difference that the carriers were not in port that day.
I think the video you're talking about is the one, History Buffs, Toro, Toro, Toro. It does go through it. So,
okay. Cool.
Yep.
Yeah. I've heard of the channel, but I'm not subscribed to it. Just general
link
history.
Link in the show notes, folks. Link in the show notes.
Just general history. One of my favorite channels I've discovered is The History Guy, and another one is Today I Found Out, and they have like three or four other channels associated with them.
You know, you should go through your blah, 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 blah. You should go through your subscription list. I've done some HBR subscription tools shows coming up for offline viewing, and then we could do the same thing, a series on interesting YouTube channels similar to what we have with interesting podcasts.
Yeah, Bookworm, sorry. It is the push to talk is kind of buried in Plumble. So that's probably something I should go add to the, if it's not the tutorial for Link Slugcast, maybe we should do it for HPR as well. You know, yeah, you've got Plumble. This is how to do push to talk.
Okay, if you can't figure it out, then just come on and we'll mute instead. Go ahead, Bookworm, over.
Maybe we're too mean to him. We're sorry, Bookworm. It's just that every time you talked, you just wiped out the channel.
Don't worry about it. If we're not talking, then we don't hear it back. He says, I have a lot of background noise here. So come on, say stuff, and then we'll go over at the end. And then I can mute you so that we can talk and we don't have the feedback.
Testing, testing. Is this thing on?
No.
Darn. I have to get that looked at.
Happy New Year, Klaatu.
Yeah, thanks. I think I don't know what time it is. It's a good 30 minutes in to the new year here in Auckland. Not Auckland, Wellington. Auckland time zone.
27 minutes, to be precise. Not that we're in all about that sort of thing here.
Yeah, yeah.
So, nice to talk to you again. How are you keeping?
Good. I'm really enjoying your guys' community show. I know that it's an open invite, and I always mean to join in on one of them. But it's honestly really refreshing just to hear you and Dave Morris sort of review the state of the network every month.
In our opinion, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
It also helps now when people are giving their comments on the shows, because then we don't need to comment on those shows, you know, and you get more opinions.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think I'm usually a commenter by nature, but it is important to give feedback, and so I've been trying to do that more often now. But I think just in general it's important, because I know that I've had podcasts in the past that I've always thought, oh, they're such great shows, and I'm not going to email or talk to the host, because I'm sure they get all sorts of email all the time, and then the podcast fades away or something, you know, and you feel bad because you're like, oops, I guess I should have maybe made contact and let them know that they were appreciated.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, for people who are listening and don't know, the community news shows, we do it once a month. And the idea was, well, when I started helping out, was in the entire 2 years, what was it, nearly 4 years when I started helping out, I only got one piece of feedback, and it was like, you're wrong, to a show I had done 2 years earlier.
I don't think I remember this backstory. That was why you started the community review?
Yeah,
community
I wanted show. Every show, because, yeah, you're going to have shows that are super popular, and if we interview Eric Raymond, or if we ever do manage to get Alanis Torvalds, everybody's going to download that show, and it's going to be the most popular one. Yet, that one show that tells you how to disable caps lock, that works for five guys who have spent a week shouting in their emails, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think we're here... Sorry, guys, I just cannot talk today for some reason. I can't put a coherent sentence together. But I think HBR is different from other podcasts in that we're not about the listeners, we're about the hosts, which is an entirely different perspective.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I like that, yeah.
Claude, I want to ask, and I know a lot of times you can't talk about specifics, are you involved in any movie Hollywood projects that you can tell us anything about?
Oh, heck no. I got out of that racket. I've left the film business for good this time, and I'm officially in IT.
He's got a fedora, or not a fedora, a red...
Well, yeah, I am wearing, yeah, a red fedora.
Did they give you one?
I actually had already gotten one because of my involvement with Fedora. Someone who was involved with Fedora but also worked at Red Hat gifted me a red fedora. So I showed up to the new hire orientation with a hat already. And so when they were handing them out, I just showed them that I already had one. But yeah, they do literally give them out at the new hire orientation.
Fantastic. Well, go ahead, over.
No, I was just going to congratulate Claude from escaping the rat race then, I guess.
Well, I've changed the rat race for a different rat race, but yeah, I just the film business is a lot of hours and a lot of work on stuff that you don't necessarily care about in any way, so being able to work on something that I actually believe in, that being Linux, is quite refreshing.
Getting paid to do free and open source software, awesome.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing.
How is that working out for you? Do you have to travel a lot, or working from home, or what's the story?
Yeah, it's completely...
Insofar as you can say...
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I can say pretty much anything. I mean, I don't think I am bound by any agreements, but I work remotely from my home in Wellington, or my apartment in Wellington, and we do have a local office, like maybe a 10-minute bus ride from where I am, so I can go in if I want to, but there's not really any reason to, so I generally don't. And yeah, sometimes I have to travel, like next year I'm going to travel in February. I have to go to the States to meet like my team. I've already met them in person once, but I have to, you know, sort of yearly check-in sort of thing. So I think it has averaged out that pretty much once a year I've had to travel for work, but it's not terrible.
We have the interesting thing where our teams... Well, we have a team, and then within our team, there's sub-teams, and the sub-teams, by definition, are spread all over Europe. So you have our team walk in, and then you're on your online tools the whole day because, you know, you're videoing with the guys, and you're chatting with them on group chats, and you're emailing them. And then all of a sudden, there's complete silence in the office, and then suddenly everybody will start laughing because, by definition, we're also telling jokes in the chat among ourselves, and then...
Right.
Why did I even bother coming into the...
yeah.
Very strange.
Claude, have you noticed any differences with the IBM buyout in this? This is me being interested, not me being, oh, let's see if we can get Claude to say something that'll get him in trouble.
well, I mean, technically, it hasn't gone through yet, so they still have to, like, the buy... still has to happen, like the purchase has to go through the board, I guess, is what I've been told. And I think that happens early 2019. And they're telling us nothing will change. So who knows? This will be my second time being bought out by IBM, actually. I worked at a startup that got bought by IBM back in Pittsburgh. So I'm not too nervous about this. And frankly, as long as it stays open source, I don't really care whose banner flies over it. That's kind of my thought on it.
I did hear your episode on the takeover. I think it was on GNU World Order.
Yeah, sounds right.
Having gone through a few takeovers myself, I think everything you said was just made so much sense, especially related to it's free open source software. So there you go.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this will be a good stress test of the GPL. I mean, that this is exactly the kind of thing it's supposed to mitigate / protect us all against. So let's see what happens.
And I think, in fairness, IBM, okay, they're not afraid to, have people pay for contracts. That's what they do very well.
Yeah.
But I think they, unlike other people, have a track record of... They really put Linux on the map. They put $1 billion at one point, putting Linux on the map, and you know that Linux, what is Linux ad that they had.
Yeah.
And from then, I think they've been committed to Linux as a thing. So yeah, cool.
Yeah, I don't feel like their motivation is going to be that much different than Red Hat's motivation. You know, it's going to be the same old thing. I imagine it'll just be. Let's get Linux on all the servers and all the big installations. I mean, I imagine that's what it's going to be. Yeah, of course, the hybrid cloud. So, yeah, I would love it in my dream world. I would love it if they would come out with if they had some initiative, a Linux desktop initiative, where they wanted to get a more stable version of Fedora out there to kind of compete, for lack of a better term, with Ubuntu, that sort of thing. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think they're going to be very much aligned with what Red Hat has already been doing.
Yeah, I know. The desktop market is a complete non-profit business. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
100% non-profit. I don't mean that it's a non-profit business. We're never going to make money out of it. As soon as Ubuntu went down that road, I thought, this has already been tried. It's not going to work. And actually, when they went down the mobile road as well, I said, that's not going to work. It's been tried before, but yeah.
Yeah, it's too bad.
But, well, it's very much an ancillary. We've already won the desktop.
Yeah.
We have won the desktop thing because, you know, it is, you've got Chrome, Chromebooks, and you've got Android everywhere. It's a non-thing. And Microsoft sees its future in the cloud as well, so yeah.
Very much, yeah. I think they're making that abundantly clear without really necessarily spelling it out, but it's embarrassingly obvious.
Well, I was at Christmas dinner. I go with some friends, and they're not like it. Certainly was not like an argument, But things, use Mac for this, use Windows for that, and. I probably should have. I should have been an advocate, but I didn't jump in and say, hey, those aren't the only two options.
Yeah, you got to choose your battles, especially around the holidays.
Yeah, and especially after running Linux now for nearly 15 years, I can't be dealing with the arguments because they don't make sense. Because I have 15 years of proof to say what you're spouting is wrong. And you covered this actually before, people, anybody having to listen to my drivel, you covered this in your GNU World Order shows where you said, no, it's not that investing somebody whose only expertise is Photoshop or whatever tool they happen to have, that is a bad investment in people. I'm actually not doing your show correct any justice there, now that I think of it.
No, but I mean, yeah, I think you're right. I think, if people can't look at you and see that you've been running Linux on the desktop for 15 years or whatever, and think that that's proof enough that it's a viable option, then obviously that's nothing you can say is going to change their mind about that. Because you're the living proof. So if they can't see it, then they're not going to hear it. Yeah. So,
well, I mean, it's the trouble is if you convince somebody to run Linux, you automatically become their free tech support forever.
Yeah,
I don't have a problem with that because I have a vested interest in doing it, so I'm happy to do that. And yes, there will be questions, but if you teach them the skills like CD, you know, open up a console, changing directory into something, you could go back in time and, you know, 50 years ago, you could still sit in front of some of the early Unix consoles and type something. Whereas now you can also crack open a Control-T on a Chromebook, one of the newest ones, and you've got a terminal, and the same commands still work. So it's well worth my while investing the time and effort in that. Whereas where have all the hours of teaching somebody how to use Excel 95 gone? You know, poof. So I'm
yeah, absolutely.
Basically.
Trouble is, I deal with some people really shouldn't have a computer. Well, I shouldn't say shouldn't have a computer, but when you know what I mean.
Oh, we know
your
mean.
Business as well. Yeah, the best thing that about that 15 years of Linux is, you know, I can now say to people, sorry, I've never actually used Windows Vista, or I've never used whatever Windows 10. So no, I can sit down in front of this thing and I can try my best to guess.
Yeah, strangely, that's what happens to me. I tell people to their face, I have never used this, and they still, they just don't hear that. And they're like, here, try this, you know, like, figure this out for me. And then I sit down and inevitably can figure it out because, you know, I guess it's just the difference between generically looking at a computer and troubleshooting mentally and figuring out what happens, which some people are unwilling to do, or yeah, I guess unwilling ultimately, because I mean, if they wanted to do it, they could.
Well, the trouble I have, the difference between a decent operating system like Linux and Windows, I haven't had this so much in Mac, but professionally, you know, you sit down and you get this error, and of course you Google the error, and okay, there's like these three different things that could be in Windows, or these top three things. None of them works. Then you're going down the rabbit hole chasing all these different things, and still nothing works.
Yeah, and that's when the experience, I mean, the troubleshooting can take, you know, all day. And if you can find someone who's actually used the OS that you are troubleshooting, it obviously, that would be the correct answer. Because, yeah, me fiddling around with something and hoping to come across the correct answer is just frustrating for everyone. But people still tend to look at computer people as just sort of generally computer people. We get recruited for it no matter what, which is fine. Generally, I'm happy to help. It just sometimes isn't the most efficient way to the correct answer.
Well, it just kind of reminds me, it's not on anymore. Not Boone County. One of the old comic strips that used to be in papers always depicted the computer guy as a bird with a wizard hat on.
Yeah, that's funny. I just wish, I mean, it's funny, but it's like completely wrong, you know, because, or maybe it's right, because I guess wizards are supposed to have studied to gain their knowledge, so maybe that's correct, but it's just frustrating to try to convince people that, you know, if you want to learn this stuff, you can learn it, and you can become good at this, but you just have to be patient. And you have to have, I guess, an innate desire to actually learn, which, I mean, a lot of people don't. That's not an interest that they have, and so it's not something that they're going to learn just because it's not there. The spark is not there.
Yeah, and it's also not important. What was it, years ago somebody said, yeah, a heart surgeon who could go into a operation and save people's lives and remember the exact amount of dosage of something that somebody needs to have to keep them alive in a stressful situation with all sorts of chaos going on, and that person can't remember an 8-character password. So, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I always compare it to car mechanics or car repair for myself, because I know, like, when I had a vehicle, I just always thought, oh man, I should really understand this thing. I should understand how to troubleshoot this. I should understand how to repair it. And it's just one of those things that's in the back of your mind, but you never actually take action on. And for a lot of people, that's the computer. You know, they maybe in the back of their head, they're thinking, I should learn this thing. I should really get this. I should remember this. But it just doesn't happen, because that's not their default setting of, that's not where the passion is. Like, it's somewhere else. It's cooking or painting or whatever they do.
Well, right. The computer, you know, for most people, the computer is an appliance, and it ought to just work, and when it doesn't, they get frustrated, you know. And like, I work for doctors and lawyers and stuff, and it's like, yeah, these people are, I don't think they're more intelligent than I am. It's just a matter of what interest you have. You know, I do not have the interest in memorizing the minutia of the law and knowing these things. Of course, a lot of these guys probably, you know, just like us, we go to Google, they go to their law books, and doctors and stuff. I'm not interested in, I think I'm probably intelligent enough, but I'm not interested enough in cutting people open and sticking my hands into their wet guts, you know.
Yeah, and although not to give people too much of a pass here, I will say that I think that educators, you know, we as a society of people who have to take care of education, I think we could do a better job of educating people just the basic idea of problem solving. I think that we fail pretty miserably at that. You know, it's like we just don't tell people, we don't teach people how to look at a problem and then disassemble it into separate parts and then solve each part until you have a solution. And that goes for computing, it goes for mathematics, it goes for just all kinds of things. And I think that's a failing on us as a whole. This is, we're not educating people.
I think it's getting better. I agree with you, but I think it's getting better.
I mean, I'm a little bit outside of that. I don't have kids in school. I know you probably do, Ken.
Yeah, but in some schools, I don't think education itself is great at that. You can be lucky or not. So yes, you're absolutely right. We can do better, but problem solving is becoming something that people have to tackle. And my daughter is in a school system in an Dalton type school system where they're taught to break it down and you break it up into individual parts and try and do problem solving.
Nice.
Also in the group, so that can be good.
What did you call the school? What did you call it? Dalton.
It's called Dalton. Dalton. I'll put a link.
Okay. Dalton. Yeah, I hear a lot about Montessori schools. I'm not 100% sure on what that is either. I mean, I've read about it, but I've never seen it in action, but a lot of people speak very highly of it.
I think it's a little bit too free and willy-nilly for my liking. It's similar. The Dalton school method is sort of similar in a way. Hold on, this is not what I'm looking at. The Dalton school method is similar in a way. So the kids have project-based stuff that they need to do, but it's aligned over the week. Some stuff is taught classically, so the whole class in front of the teacher explains the stuff, and then they split up and do it. And the default action is that you have to try and figure it out yourself. If you can't, then your group of four people, which changes every week or every few weeks, they have to figure it out there. And if the whole team can't figure it out, then you come to the teacher.
Nice. That's great.
It works brilliantly for some people, and it fails massively for other people. So I'm not saying it's the panacea for all education.
Yeah, you know, I took a class, a mathematics class, at the movie studio that I was working at. They were offering, like, a, you know, mathematics for 3D image stuff. And I took that class, and the teacher seemed really great at first, and he had this theory that, you know, if the students essentially taught the course, then the students are learning by teaching, and it seemed like a great theory. And then it came around to me having to teach, and generally speaking, I consider myself a pretty good teacher, and I was studying up on this topic, and I thought I'd had it, you know. I thought for sure it was like on a matrix transform, I think a 2D matrix transform, and I thought I totally got it, and I'd watched a bunch of Khan Academy videos on it and some YouTube videos, and I'd read articles about it, and I was ready, and I got up in front of the class and I started teaching it, and at the end of my little lecture, someone who knew this stuff raised his hand and was like, shouldn't you have done it this way? And it was a completely different, you know. And so I'd gotten up there and talked for 20 minutes completely wrong, and so I don't know what good that did me or anyone else who wasn't familiar with the topic yet. And at that point I felt like maybe the theory was, maybe it had some problems with it.
And now that's burnt into other people's minds.
Right, yeah. And to this day, I don't remember how to do the thing or even what I was what I taught on, because it was just, it was all wrong. It was all, throw it out.
Very, very, very frustrating.
We're coming up on 12 o'clock UTC.
Really? I thought it was, oh, okay, sure. 12 o'clock UTC. I must be 13 hours ahead, because it was just 12 o'clock here.
Yeah, because we got summertime.
Oh, okay. Sorry, yeah, 13
time.
Hours.
No, we don't have much time.
It is 13 hours.
I don't feel bad. We got a whole confusion. You know, we were one notch off on everything and had to move the show notes around earlier.
Yeah, it's a real puzzler trying to figure out all the time zones. It's phenomenally entertaining.
Silly.
Well, how this came up, I set one of my clocks to UTC, and it's, well, that's an hour off of their show notes. And I asked Ken, and he said, no. And then he figured out, we jumped the gun one notch.
Well, I have family on the East Coast, so I generally, I know I should probably go by UTC, but I like, in my mind, it's easier to equate to relate times here to Eastern Standard Time, just because, you know, of all the other time zones in the world, that's the one I'm sort of more aware of. So I just kind of go off of whatever you guys say EST is going to be.
Yeah, I am happy with UTC because it's the base time in Ireland. So exactly, I've got an
idea. Oh, nice. Yeah.
And I can't imagine that's why I can't propose UTC as the solution for everybody. It is definitely the solution for anything on a computer. I can't imagine. I would like to have an easy solution where we all do this, you know, like the Esperanto thing. But yeah,
I don't understand why we don't all just use the same numbers and we just adjust what those numbers mean to us locally. I don't get that personally, but I've proposed that idea online once, and people got really up in arms about the travesty of losing noon being, you know, the time that you eat lunch. It's like, who cares? Like, why does it matter that you eat lunch at 11:59 a.m.? Why can't it be some other number?
Well, the funny thing is, in China, they have a one centralized time, but on the East Coast, North, South, West.
East. Hong Kong, right? Surely.
Yeah, so the time zones make sense if you're on the East Coast, but on the West, in the West of the country, on the steppes and stuff, then it doesn't make sense because your noon is like 6 in the evening or something.
Yeah.
So they operate an unofficial time. They're local.
Oh, interesting.
It just makes sense.
Well, now, by my calculations, it is 12 o'clock UTC, and greetings to small regions of Russia, the Marshall Islands, five more. Yeah, we need to fill that in sometime. What the five more are, because they probably are like, hey, and I'm going to butcher this, and you're Funati Fudi, no, Funafuti, Yaren, and Tuarwa. I know how it's pronounced Tuarwa, at least.
I've not really heard of many of those places, but there are lots of places in the world.
Struggling with portals at the moment. Any cool events planned for the year? Are you going to LinuxConf?
I am going to LinuxConf. I'm actually speaking there. I'm giving a talk on Lua.
Nice.
It'll be my first time.
To that one.
Yeah. I've been wanting to go. But until this year, I didn't really have the time to do it. But the new job has afforded me a little bit more flexibility.
Are you going as Tlatu, or are you going as employee?
Employee.
Very nice.
If I see Linus, I'll try to grab a interview with him.
Yes.
Cool. I'd like to hear that.
Obviously.
I mean, I don't even know if he'll actually be there. I know he frequents it, but I don't know how frequent is, and I'm also pretty sure that he's probably difficult to pin down for an interview, I would imagine.
Yeah, he doesn't like interviews, and I think he may be taking some time off from the computer as well. So
that'd be a tough one. I feel like someone who's interviewed or who's well known, I feel like it would be difficult to interview them just because it's like, what are you going to ask them that hasn't already been covered in 30 other interviews? And that kind of annoys me when just the same topics get, you know, sort of dragged over and over and over again.
I actually had an idea for that, for live,
oh, yeah?
Specifically,
okay.
Which I will talk to you offline about.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I'll do that.
If you do get the opportunity, I have a good way to get around that.
Okay, cool. I will be interested in hearing this offline.
I did, for the first time, have the experience of being recognized at a Linux conference.
Really?
Itself. You know, I had a couple of people come up to me that said, yeah, I know that voice.
Yeah, that's great. That's really cool.
Oh.
I got recognized at a little tech thing the other week. I was at this, it was like a Christmas party, sort of. It was like a sort of everyone in tech in the city sort of got together for this sort of convention, except it wasn't really a convention. So it was kind of a weird thing. And I was there as a Red Hat employee. And so I had a name tag on, and this person saw the name tag and recognized my name from some articles I wrote online. And was just like, hey, I read your articles all the time. And I was blown away. I was just like, that had never happened before. It was just, that was crazy.
I have this weird thing, right, where despite all my HBR stuff, I have this series of articles on how to get a particular type of firewall working on Linux on my website, which I keep up to date as new distributions come out, and you're forced to do yet another workaround to get it working. And all of a sudden, you'd be walking around and you go, hey, you're Ken Fallon, you've got the... Yeah, the firewall.
That's cool. I mean, it's great. Go ahead, sorry.
No, I was going to tell Ken, I keep meaning, after all these years, sit down and do your reverse tunneling tutorial, never get around to doing it.
Or reverse tunneling. I always feel a little bit guilty doing it because you know you're violating 400 security policies and setting it up.
It's one of my favorite things about being in IT is that you can connect with the people who have influenced your success in the industry, as well as, you know, if you're doing this for fun, then just your personal life. And I love that about this industry, and I never have seen that before. You know, I mean, you go up to someone in the movie business and say, oh, I really like your stuff. You know, you'll get strong-armed to the ground, you know, like, leave this person alone. Who are you? How dare you speak to them? But in the IT industry, you can just go up to, you know, the developer of Slackware, tell him that you really like his distribution and that you've been using it for the past decade, and he's totally cool about it. It's great.
And that you've been contributing money and it's going to somebody else. That was well, sucky.
Whole other problem, yeah. I hope that things have gotten sorted for the long term on that. I haven't really heard a whole lot of sort of reporting after it sort of got solved. And I'm not clear on whether the short term it's a short term solution or if something has gotten set in place.
Thing came up on the last Linux Lugcast. One of the listeners wrote in and said, yeah, there's a thing setting up Slackware on ARM that sets, by default, it sets the hard drive to read only. And places where he went finally found a Reddit, instructions on how to get it unborked, you know, and all that. And one of our contributors, Netminer, you know, he was saying, yeah, I think probably at that point I would go install a different distro before I would go through all that stuff. And I immediately thought of you, Claude 2. You know, now if you're Claude 2, you would fix it.
I mean, I mean, it's open source, and I think that's probably the expected response, honestly. I mean, if you can, then fix it and then keep going. But at the same time, you know, you don't want it. It is a lot to ask people to fix something and then jump through hoops to contact you with the fix. You know, like if they can't reach the person who they need to contact in order to update a document or something, then I think that's a problem with the process. Which is why docs.slackware.com is so great, because people can edit that. It's a wiki. People can edit it. So that's gotten a lot better in terms of user contribution.
I'm just standing here listening to you two guys talk and thinking, gosh, what is this podcast? When did I download it? Forgetting. I can walk over.
It's
and
happening
press
right
to
now.
It's really weird. Really nice.
Also, that's...
I'll probably be on the bus hearing you two guys talking and then start talking out loud in the bus again and be embarrassing myself.
No, it's just deja vu, because I think I just, I know I just watched that on YouTube, the clip from Spaceballs, you know, the whole, you know, when did this happen? It happened now. When, you know.
When they're rewinding the tape or fast forwarding or whatever they're doing, yeah. I mean, actually, and it shouldn't be ignored that with open source, you don't necessarily have to contact the person with the fix. I mean, that's the best way to do it, but you can always write your own, you know, a blog post or a note somewhere and post it online so that others can find it if they run into the same problem. So, I mean, it's not ideal because it's not getting merged into master, as it were, but it's still a possibility.
Well, in this particular glitch, you know, rather than, you know, it's probably enough to let the developer know, hey, for some reason, this is coming out and it's setting the drive to read only, and, you know, fix it on your end rather than, you know, putting out documentation. Okay, yeah, you've installed this and it's broke, and do this to fix it is probably not the best way.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, just filing the bug is oftentimes all that's necessary. It's just like, hey, I don't know if you knew this, but this is happening. I will say about the ARM thing, too, is that there's the ARM market or whatever just seems so... It's just really difficult, I think, to pin all of those different devices down. So I think a lot of times installing... Well, even many Linux distributions, installing it onto something, you're looking for an image for that thing. You know, you're installing the OpenSUSE image onto your Raspberry Pi 3 version A or whatever they call it, and if you have Raspberry Pi 2 Rev B, then you're looking for an image for that one. So it's very specific to the device. It's like a cell phone almost. You know, it's like everything has to be exactly what you're looking for, which annoys me. And Slackware is a lot more generic than that. They provide ARM builds, but you have to do your own bootloader and your own firmware and all this other stuff. So it isn't like all the others where you just get an image and DD it over to your micro SD card, pop it into your device, and boot.
Well, it reminds me of, 35 years ago, when they installed Unix on the servers at my college. And
I'm
going to
call
you
back in a second.
And it wasn't like, you know, you got a binary image. It was like you downloaded the source code, and then you had to adapt that source code to particular hardware that you had.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the idea of portable code didn't mean what it means today, where it's portable, it's easy, you just run it anywhere. It's like portable, yeah, you can adapt it and then recompile it, and then it'll run.
Yeah, I remember that weekend. They were like, yeah, the server... You know, everything's going to be offline this weekend because we're figuring out this Linux thing. Or not Linux, Unix, sorry.
I have been playing around with Unix proper lately in the form of Open Indiana, which is the new version of Open Solaris. It's been pretty interesting.
It's one of the things I've always wanted to try playing with and never downloaded and done. I should.
Yeah, I mean, I ran Open Solaris for a while back when it was a thing, and then... I just had a spare drive on my laptop and just figured do something a little bit different. So I've been playing around with Open Indiana. And it's coming along. It's coming along really nicely, really.
Do they have a GUI for it beyond X or?
No, it is the X server, if that's what you mean. And then they're using I don't remember if it's Mate or Cinnamon. I get those two mixed up. I think it's Mate. Styled very much to look like GNOME 2 when Open Solaris was was a thing. So it's got the same theme and everything. It looks for all the world just like Open Solaris.
See, I have, I think not very common experience. When we were in school, AT&T, back around the whole breakup thing, donated to Kansas State about a dozen what they called Unix PCs, also known as 3B1s. And, okay. it was pretty much, had two 20 gig hard, or not 20 gig, 20 meg hard drives, which was huge for the day. But, came up and is pretty much X Windows or some sort of precursor of X Windows, because it looks just exactly like it. But of course, everything we were doing on the command line, so we just dropped straight into a terminal, never used the GUI. But these were the ones that they came back a year later, and they needed these for an interface to the phone exchange machine, so they took them all back.
Wow, that's funny.
But we were all looking at these, man, we wish we could get one of those, take them home. Of course, they were way more than a standard PC in those days, but, if you were to buy one. But, these were the things we all wanted.
Yeah, I feel like it's a really unique experience to have. I mean, I certainly don't have it, but it must be a unique experience to have a memory of a time when you wanted a Unix box at home. Like now, if you grew up or whatever knowing about Linux and having Linux at your disposal, the idea of lusting after a Unix box on the desktop is just such a weird idea to me.
And we had, we had early Macs, and it's like, man, this is crap. We don't want,
Yeah.
And of course, there was no GUI for DOS boxes in that day. But we were like, what is this mouse crap, man? We don't want this.
Yeah. So, that's a really unique experience to me as well. Because I was raised on computers with a mouse as a pretty much a requirement. you could do probably more without a keyboard on Mac than you could on a Mac without a mouse, I would say. So, yeah.
Well, a few years later, we had Windows and we're into it. But I had the experience when one of my earliest customers is like, yeah, I don't want that GUI thing because they're going to have to take my secretaries are going to have to take their hands off the keyboard to grab that mouse, and that's not efficient.
That makes sense.
Ah, that's so brilliant.
We had an IBM program written by one of the guys in work to do help desk management at one, and it was perfect. And then I had to replace it with a GUI-based off-the-shelf product. It's just so frustrating when something that works has been thrown out because you're replacing it with something that's prettier.
It's so depressing.
But then it's a job, so you have to get used to it. So get over it, get on with it, or leave.
Yeah.
I went and got myself some cheap Dutch coffee.
Nice.
I feel Honky should have inserted the coffee, go get yourself a coffee thing that you have. But I killed the conversation again. Sorry about that, folks.
No, it was over. I think we finished up with that topic.
Well, on coffee, and I think about you, Claude, too, when I brew some. But on Black Friday, I did get myself a what's the thing for the little individual cups? I had it in my head just a second ago.
We're not going to even talk about that on this network. It would be advertising for that horrible, horrible system.
Okay, well, I did get a compatible, which I don't think is keyed in. You can't put somebody else's cups in under whatever favorware. A lot cheaper.
Yeah, but I mean the coffee that it produces is just not very good, is it? I had to use one at work once, and it was just dismally bad.
Well, I've come kind of the same conclusion. It's convenient, but Of course, the coffee is just incredibly ridiculously expensive. I did buy off Walmart some, you know, variety packs or whatever to try, but it's like, I know it's the same way with my beer. You know, if my beer is going to have a flavor, I want to taste the flavor, not just the hint of a flavor. And I am the guy that if, you know, I go to a convenience store, and I'm going to horrify you, Claude, too, but, you know, I get the coffee, and then there is the add-on machine, you know, the vanilla flavor or other flavor.
Oh, no. You're right. You're horrifying me.
Yeah, so, you know, I just go pump, 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 you know, into my coffee. And, you know, and all these, you know, I get all these different Keurig packs, and it's like, yeah, most of them just taste like coffee to me.
They do have a reusable thing where you can put your own coffee into it. But I don't know, in my experience, that it renders the same dismal results, because it's just pouring hot water through some coffee grinds. It just doesn't, I don't think it simmers quite enough. It doesn't steep enough.
Yeah, and I have those. I haven't tried them yet. Of course, when I do, just as horrifying, it'll probably be Folgers. But, you know, other than that, I've got some loose tea that'll probably work as well in those things.
Yeah, probably.
50, I keep buying, I want to get a kind of settle on a good regular beer to have from time to time. And so we're spoiled for choice here with having so many Belgian breweries around. But I keep buying beer that I've bought before and remembering I didn't like the taste of it. Do you have like a form or something that you use to fill out your beer reviews?
No, I wish I did. My preference is a malty beer rather than a hoppy beer, so I think you're on the right track with Belgians, in my opinion. X1101, you know, he's a big hops man, so, you know, my favorite beer is always one I haven't tried before.
Yeah, exactly, which is fine. I don't mind trying new beers, but I don't want to try a beer that I've tried before, and it seems like senseless where I'm continually going into the shop and going, oh, yeah, they've changed the, you know, they'll maybe put it in a new pack, or you're buying a different bottle size, or they've changed something with the branding. And I feel like, you get conned into buying the same beer again. So on your beer review thing, which you did with HPR some time ago, you were going through the beers in a sort of structured way. So is there like a office template that you could make, or things that you should check for in the beer? Alcohol content, the name, the brand, blah, blah.
I don't know about that. I think keep experimenting, see what you like. I mean, shoot, the beer I drink the most is cheap and powerful. Which allows me to experiment with more expensive beers that sometimes I don't like as well. I mean, the beer I drink the most is Steel Reserve, which, like I said, it's a lager, which is unusual for me. I prefer ales, but it's a malty lager, and it's inexpensive, but probably not something you see over there. And I'm sure probably,
yeah, probably
you've got way more selection, I would think, over there than I have in rural Kansas. I mean, maybe not. But, you know, I really like to frequent brew pubs, you know, and try their experimental beers.
How do you keep track of your coffee tasting, Klaatu?
I really don't. I don't track anything like that. I try stuff that I like, I remember, and then when I lose access to that thing, I move on to something else, I'm not very scientific about it at all. And I do like, I mean, I like a lot of different kinds of coffees. Like, I'm not a coffee snob, really. I like bad coffee a lot of times. So, yeah, I just go with what I like.
Probably open a text file called beer.txt or something.
Yeah, we probably ought to come up with a standard. I mean, and you guys will think I'm weird, but...
Way past that tattoo. We're 50. We're way past that.
But it's still dark outside, so I'm with you guys, and I am drinking a beer. And the one I just picked out is Garden Party Lager by Free State, which is a brewery in Lawrence, Kansas, the home of Kansas University. I try not to hold that against them, but it is very refreshing. It's the first time I've had it. But it's got notes of cucumber, basil, and juniper. You know, and you know, this would be very good if you were thirsty.
Cool. Kansas, the first state I ever entered in the U.S., not counting New York Airport or JFK.
I didn't know that. Why did you come to Kansas?
Puritan Bennett. Did you ever hear of them?
Puritan what?
Puritan Bennett. Medical device manufacturer. Got taken over by Nalcor. Nalcor Puritan Bennett. Got taken over by Mallinckrodt. Got taken over by Tyco Medical.
Okay, I'm sure I've heard of some of those.
Go ahead over.
Were you developing a particular product, or were you just doing IT in general for them?
We were IT in... we did the European IT firm. And then every so often I go over to the head office because the teams I worked with were over there.
So what city were they located in? Like Kansas City or Wichita or...?
Kansas City, Kansas, sir.
Okay, cool.
And I arrived the first weekend and... I didn't have I had a provisional, like a learner's permit in Ireland, and I rang the, the statute of limitations in the story has exceeded, so I can probably tell it now. They, I opened the map and like did about 2 inches of my fingers. I went, oh, that's a drive going down to Tulsa, you know, 24 hours from Tulsa. You know the song? So I thought, yeah, take a little drive down there from Kansas to Tulsa. How long can that be? Rang the the car rental place, and the guy said, I said, look, I've got a provisional driver's license. Do you think that's going to be is that going to be a problem? And the guy says, do you have a major credit card? I says, I got a Visa. And he says, I foresee no problems, sir.
America. So,
walk down to the place anyway, and come in, and the guy goes, yeah, I got this, gonna give you an upgrade, sir, today, and it's a black Trans Am, just like what's his face at?
Burt Reynolds?
Yeah, exactly. So here was I, yeah, exactly, that's it, yeah. Typical, I couldn't get more American, and the car was right parked right outside of the office, yeah. So I get in anyway, and car starts going bong, bong, bong. I go, why is it going bong, bong, bong? Okay, I'm in America. Okay, seatbelt, seatbelt. Click. Okay, stops going bong, bong, bong. Try to start the car. Car wouldn't start. No clue what was going on. So just getting so frustrated. And the guy was then looking out at me. So I had to put the map up on the front of the windscreen so I could figure out how the car started, so it looked like I wasn't being weird. Eventually I figured out I needed to put my foot in the brake in order to move the gear shift. Really. First time driving an automatic, by the way.
Wow, that's funny.
Don't feel too bad when we got my dad's transport van, which was a van with a ramp, so we could get his chair, a power chair on and all that stuff and locked in. It took me like 2 weeks to figure out where the dimmer switch was because I had never driven a vehicle, the dimmer switch wasn't on.
Yeah, yeah. And I also learned that day that you should always carry cash on you in the States. Always dollars everywhere for the tolls and stuff.
That's a help, you know, because that at least always works. Of course,
It's gotten a little bit better now because they've got the Easy Pass, right? Do they have that in Kansas, like the for tolls, the Easy Pass?
Oh, of course. I don't have one, but yeah. And these days, you know, cash machines and whatever. You know, when I was in college, my parents would tell me, "Oh, yeah, we'll send you a credit card or not credit cards, traveler's checks." You know, because those are safe. You got to have traveler's checks.
Wow.
Yes, I am old.
Well, the company at the time's credit card was American Express, which you can't use anywhere in Europe. It's just completely... So luckily I had a Visa at the time.
Well, American Express isn't much better here. Well, I shouldn't say that. I mean, of every place that takes Visa and MasterCard, there's maybe 70% that takes American Express. I may be off on that. I don't want to get sued by American Express next week, but definitely there's a difference.
I had to get an American Express card for work for a flight because the travel agency inexplicably only accepted payments from New Zealand with American Express. It was so strange, and so I had to get an American Express just for this one flight. Really weird.
Well, my bank here in the last year switched from MasterCard to Visa, and the Visa Fraud Protector, whatever, pops up all the time, and it's like, here a month ago, they denied Walmart.com.
Yeah, I don't. I would love to hear some Hacker Public Radio shows about what exactly a lot of those verification systems are doing, like especially in the credit card realm. Although I imagine no one can legally talk about that, but I'd sure love to hear an episode about it.
Bob can always send one in, and we'll find somebody to text to speech it or narrate it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I was talking to Ken earlier this morning. I changed my internet provider to something called blazinghog.com, and apparently that did get past Visa. I'm surprised. I mean, first, if I were to set up a professional website, blazinghog.com is not going to be my first choice. I mean, if you Google Blazing Hog, you come up with a bunch of barbecue restaurants.
Well, that's the thing. I wonder how much of it's even a human, you know, making a judgment call versus just a bunch of algorithms timing different purchases and flagging things that are not normal and all that other stuff. And I mean, I've never been contacted by a credit card or a bank even about a purchase and had the result be, oh my gosh, I'm so glad you contacted me because you've intercepted a bunch of false charges. But I have heard from people who say that that has happened to them. So it's a mystery to me as to what exactly really is going on and how they do flag different purchases and so on.
When we would go to Ireland, that they would occasionally ring us up and say, I'm seeing transactions over here in Ireland all of a sudden. So they say, oh, before we go on holidays, we tell them, we're going to be gone in 2 weeks, so just don't bother with this stuff.
Yeah, I used to do that too. We've been joined by Jeroen. I think I said that name correctly. Jeroen.
Well, it sounds similar to how I pronounce it.
That's good enough for me. How are you? I've been enjoying your episodes a lot.
Well, thank you very much. I'm just trying to get this mumble set up on my daily workstation, so I hope it keeps on working.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that you can hear us and that we can hear you, and this is the first time you've joined, you're doing well. You're doing better than I do pretty much every time I join, and I've joined like 20 times.
And
yeah, well, actually, it's the second time that I joined Mumble. So the first time was during my holiday in France, I believe, when I gave some feedback on my first podcast and how I experienced it. Let's put it mildly like that.
Okay.
And also, welcome to Mongo, who seems to be muted but listening to us.
Yeah, it's always hard to tell who means to be muted and is just listening in versus who means to call in and just is having a hard time routing their sound.
So, Klaatu, just one question. The way your name is spelled in the channel, is that the official spelling of your name?
No, I don't. I have no idea why I did that. I'm sure at the time I had a reason, but it's just arbitrary.
Okay.
I think I thought it looked heavy metal to have dots over the A's and the U.
Yeah, well, in a way it does, yeah.
Sadly, I don't know what, you know, those dots suggest to speakers of a language that actually uses dots over letters. So I have no idea what that would actually do to the name.
Well, the A with double points in German would sound like a E, short E, and U would also the U would be a U. Yeah, something like that.
Definitely not the intent.
I'm not native German, but it depends, of course, on the language. I mean,
that's true.
You also see those letters in, I think, Sweden and Norway. So, and they probably do something similar, but not exactly identical. So, well, all bets are off. I don't know.
And there's Stuzz. Stuzz is from Australia. He must be in the new year by now. But he's muted, I just noticed.
Hi, guys.
Hey, Tony.
How's things going?
Pretty great.
Hi, Tony. Hi, Ken.
Where are you located, Tony? Are you in the new year yet? Probably not.
No, I'm in the UK, so it's 1:45 1 in the afternoon here of New Year's Eve. Yeah, so, I've got a while to go yet.
So are you a native UK guy, Stas?
Sorry, Tony? Yeah, I am. I'm new, native to this country. I live in Blackpool on the west coast of the UK. And I was born and bred in South Manchester, which is about 50 miles away.
Okay, then. Well, let me be the first to offer you my humble apologies for one of the latest Dutch musical burps called The Reunions. And it's five guys who can't hold a tune even if their life would depend on it. And they're sort of singing something like Britain Come Back as a sort of a what they consider to be a positive addition to the whole Brexit discussion. Really bad.
I don't know about the song, but the message sounds great.
Yeah, it's I think the message as they try to convey them is from a positive angle, but the way they've realized it is I there are no words really. There are a lot of everything else from the Netherlands is better than what they have produced. Let's put it like that. But I guess their heart's in the right place. I think that's something we can agree on. But other than that, it's on YouTube. I mean, if you have 5 seconds, I think that's all you need. It's really, really, really bad.
So, did you start on time at midday our time? Did you manage to get everyone in?
I'm
I think so.
Yes. Exactly on time. Everything working super. Nothing could possibly go wrong.
Nothing at all, Ken.
So, Ken, when I recall correctly, in one of the last episodes of the monthly news, HBR monthly news, you mentioned that you wanted to see the graphs associated with my podcast on monitoring oxygen levels in my stepchild. Did you get that we added the URL to a blog post of mine to that article, so you can probably see the graphics?
Yeah, no, I saw it coming in because I'm on that list.
Okay, great.
And thanks very much for that. I'm going to I'm going to be hopefully. Unfortunately, my daughter has something where I need to monitor her blood oxygen. Nothing serious, so we're going to get some kit from Deal Extreme and Aldi Express and places like that, and then see if we can hook up some of your stuff to it and do some plotting, and so your work hopefully will lead to some more stuff. Shows for HBR.
Unexpected twist to the story. So I hope everything will turn out fine, of course. After I published the blog some years ago, I got an email at some point from a guy in America who had done similar things with his child, but he made a really nice looking Kibana dashboard, but that was, well, not what I was going after. So if you like, I can look in my gigabytes of mail logs and probably find the original mail again, if you like to get
No panic, we'll see how it goes. Although I am looking for the show for HBR, people who have expertise with Kibana would be good, because it's a useful skill to have.
Yeah, that would be a nice subject in a way. It's the getting started part that's always difficult. So yeah, sorry, can't help you there. But I mean, I did do some Elk Stack, but I never got any further than just installing it and making it work and not tuning or making nice dashboards.
Yeah, the problem I have with Kibana is you have it running, the data's in there, and then, okay, now what?
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm
exactly
sure there's somebody listening who is thinking, oh, I have nothing to contribute to HBR, but they do know Kibana. Well, now would be an ideal time to send in a show.
Yeah, that would be a good idea.
Ken, do you know anyone that listened to the whole of episode 3000?
Yes, I did. I actually found it very interesting, because every time we hit a show, I was going, oh yeah, I remember that one. Oh, I remember that one. Oh, that one was really useful in that time when I did that thing. No, I haven't used that one yet, but I was planning to. Oh, that's where that show, like, there was a whole go of, as I was listening to it, I was thinking, oh, well, I'm going to listen to this because I have a thing where I promise I will listen to every show on the network. And actually, I thought it was going to be a bigger chore than it was. I went back and was actively engaged with every show that went on.
Wow, you're kind of selling me on the show. I did not download that one even. I didn't even bother downloading it.
You should, because it's like, oh, this is when... What, Dave Morris only came on then, and he's already done 102
yeah.
shows?
Yeah, I listened to some of it. I had to listen to some of it, but I think I got about 20 minutes in, and it started to grate on me, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I was planning on doing it on another text-to-speech thing, but to be honest, everything collapsed. Nothing was capable of doing it except eSpeak, and I was thinking, well, eSpeak is the voice of HBR, so yeah.
You know, with better planning, and I don't mean that in a mean way, but if we thought about this earlier, we could have had, like, several different hosts, like, read, you know, like, hey, Klaatu, you read every third show, Ken, you read every sixth show, you know, and then we could have, well, that would have been a lot of editing,
who would
too,
edit that
but,
together?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right.
That
yeah,
show
yeah.
already took me 6 hours to make because
yeah,
of the...
Yeah.
It was an hour.
Mm-hmm. All right.
That
yeah,
show
yeah.
already took me 6 hours to make because
yeah,
of the.
Yeah.
It was a nightmare. Sometimes you have a show like that and it goes bam, 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 and it comes out good, but that one was just a nightmare.
Well, it's not
particularly because there was one gap in the episodes between 3000 and nobody was filling it. Fill the show, because then I can do the rest.
So, did you use a script to get the episode?
Yeah, we have them in the database, but then you've got the TWAT episodes where, we really need, it's on the to-do list as well, to get those incorporated into the HBR database system, and we're probably going to look at a new database system going forward. But I used a script, and then you have the names are all wrong, and you listen to it a little bit, and then I was using... some text-to-speech APIs, and then they bombed out, and you could only do 20 minutes a day, and it's just a pain.
Okay, do I understand correctly that you're talking about replacing the eSpeak scripting with something else?
What I wanted to do, and I still want to do after your episode, after your comments on your first episode, was to get a replacement for eSpeak. or a different voice for eSpeak that would be more modern and more up-to-date. Ideally, so I contacted the guys from, what do you call that, open source in-home automation system?
Mycroft,
that's it.
So Mycroft have taken had taken Popey's voice from the Ubuntu UK podcast, so therefore it was possible to do it, but they use a closed source engine to generate it, and yeah, I didn't want to go down that road. So
what about Speaks or Festival?
Yeah, I've used both of them. They're both a pain to set up, and the quality of the audio that you get out is no better.
Ah, okay. Because when I was just setting up Mumble, it had a spoken wizard as one of the first screens, and it said, "Well, this is generated by Speaks," so it sounded pretty good to me.
Yeah, Speak. But what I'd like would be a way to take a voice. Now, Manon, who does the outro text, has said that she will do it, to have a voice, an open source voice based that we could use in HBR for that sort of stuff.
That'd be really neat.
You could mix the two. That, can you read this bit, and then we'll text to speech the rest of it, so to go from her actual voice to the robot voice and back again.
So you use somebody's voice to create a digital definition or something?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
but
okay.
The tools for doing that are closed source, so I can't do the voice. So no use to us.
Right. And if Mumble is open source, and Mumble has this wizard, and Mumble speaks...
Yeah, Mumble uses eSpeak, so it's the same tool.
Okay. But then it's the definition which makes it...
No, sorry. Jeroen, I think you misheard. I think it said this is the... I think it's talking about Speaks, the codec that it is using.
Yeah.
I don't believe that voice was being generated by eSpeak. I think it was speaking to you through the Speaks codec. I could be wrong.
Ah, okay, yeah. I'm no expert there, so...
I don't know. I'm
probably wrong.
I remember what you're talking about. I haven't heard it in a while, but I think that it wasn't saying what you think it was saying. Although I'm happy to be wrong, because you're right, that voice does sound good.
So if anybody can get a voice that's as easy to do as GNF install or apt-get install, blah, that's fine. But when you go down the road of Festival or HTSS or something like that, you need a PhD in linguistics to get it installed. That is what I'm looking for. It's eSpeak --voice=blah.
Oh, okay.
And if there's a voice expert that can do the blah bit and then give that to us as a binary blob, then I'm also fine. And also produce a HBR series about the blah bit, then everyone's happy.
Yeah, and that's how those acronyms in IT are born. You know, somebody says blobbit, everybody laughs, and then suddenly it's this keyword that everybody knows and understands, and everybody outside of IT has, what are the hell are they talking about?
Foo.com. If it wasn't for Klaatu, and thank you, I would never have known what Foo and Bar was, but Klaatu, early on in the podcast experience, explained where they came from. And I went, thank you! Finally, somebody's explained.
I don't remember this, but you're welcome.
It was even before your urban camping series. You did it on, I think it was before GNU World Order. Was GNU World Order?
Wow.
So that is a similar IT myth, like the printer on fire bit, right?
What? What's the printer on fire?
That was actually a thing.
Oh, well, yeah, exactly. Well, so in a, I often tell this when I do when I give a Linux training. You know the old parallel printer cables? They had two status bits. So you could do 0, 1, 2, and 3. That's the max. 0 would be printer offline, 1 would be printer online, 2 would be out of paper, and 3 would be printer on fire, actually. And if you look at the Linux source code, it's still there. And it's because back in the day, you had a printer with, and this is hard to describe, but I'll try it anyway. It was a printer, a high volume printer that would print one line at a time. And to do that, it used a sort of a band of cloth that was pulled through a bucket of ink. And at the top of this band of cloth, it would be moved by two cylinder iron cylinder bars in a way. Yeah? Because the cloth was at some place sewn together, it was a little thicker there. And occasionally it would get stuck where the two metal bars, one of them was rotating to pull this band from above back under to the bucket and then up again for printing. And when it got stuck, those iron bars just kept on rotating, and at some point it would just heat up, and well, guess what, the printer would actually catch fire. At least that's a story that I've been told.
That's great. I'd not heard that one before.
I remember one from early in computing, you know. Actually, the IBM PC was one of the first computers that advertised that you could not enter a code and fry the computer. The TV show Halt and Catch Fire is not really very far from the truth. There was a guy came up with the code that would vibrate the hard drive so that given long enough, it would throw the computer off the table and crash.
Well, this brings, when you talk about that, that's what it's a couple of years ago, but that what was something that really amazed me was the construction of the Stuxnet virus. That it was sort of a binary in stages. It would decrypt one part after the other. So the first stage would be, am I running on a PC with an Iranian keyboard? If yes, I will decrypt my next payload. If no, I will just do nothing. And the next one would be, if I'm running on a system with an Iranian keyboard, do I have a controller for a Siemens S5 programmable logic controller on it? If not, let's leave it at that. If yes, I will decrypt the next part. And then it would download a virus into this programmable logic controller that would then check if a certain motor hardware controller was in the system. If not, it would do nothing. If yes, it would check the frequency, the rotation frequency of this motor. And if this frequency motor was 1453 per minute, cycles per minute, then it would probably be plutonium. What's the word for it? Enricher plant, exactly. And it would change the frequency to start oscillating between 0 and 3000 and back to 0 and back to 3000 as fast as possible. And it would actually ruin the complete machine, which it's a very advanced type of warfare, but from a technical perspective, it's interesting. Let's put it like that.
Those naughty kids in their basements, hey?
Yeah, right.
Tony H just pointed out that it is now the new year in Vanuatu, which I know where that is now because I live near enough of it that I've actually heard of it.
Cool. Well, in that case, everybody, happy new year then.
How is life in New Zealand, Tlatu?
That's fantastic. It's really, really just beautiful. And this holiday, my partner has planned out like a big staycation where we're visiting all the places that, you know, you're you should visit, but you never do. So we've just been going on day trips just every day, and it's been fantastic. It's been great. It's a beautiful country.
Well, I've told you before, you know, all the locations in, it sounds silly, but Hercules and Xena, you know, I want to come over there and see.
Yeah, there's actually a really good show that they were producing. I don't know if they're going to keep producing it, but it was, what is it, Legends of Monkey or something like that, and it's a very sort of Xena, the Hercules style sort of fantasy show.
This was the copy of the Chinese clone thing?
Maybe.
Ages ago.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Because it's like, it's called like the New Legends of Monkey or something like that. You know, it's like, it gives me the impression
so bad
that it's...
was good.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I want to say that's on Netflix.
It might be. It's weird. That's another thing I would love to hear more about on anything on Hacker Public Radio is how in the world do networks in this new global, you know, entertainment scene, how do they figure out, like, why do they enforce regions still? And then how does Netflix sort of, and the TV networks, how do they dice up their offerings? It's so weird because, like, things that'll come on TV in New Zealand will show up in Netflix in the US, and things that show up on Netflix, you know, it's weird. They split it up in a really weird, unexpected way.
Would you like an answer to that? Because I do know the reasons.
Oh, cool. All right. Go for it.
Yeah, because this, as somebody who works for a cable network and is responsible for a pan-European thing, and these thoughts are the thoughts of me and not the company, and this information doesn't come from the company, it just comes from other people in the industry. Yeah.
Cool.
So this is my discussion. It's not anything to do with my employer, just so you know. Anyway, back in the day, you had film reels, yeah? Physical content. So Gone with the Wind would come out, you'd have 27 reels or whatever, and they would be distributed out. So they would go to the premieres in the big places in the US, and they would get played there. And then they would go from, you know, one movie theater to the next, and then they would be played there, and then to the next, and they'd be played there. Then all those reels would be gathered up, put on a ship, and sent to the next region, which was the UK. Now, the shitty reel that has been playing in all the movie theaters in the US is now in the UK, and it goes to the premiere, and they play it there in the premiere, yeah? And then when all those movie reels are done, then they go to the next region. So that's where all the regions come from. Everyone with me so far?
Yep.
Okay. So you're saying to yourself, but Ken, then we have DVDs. Yes, but everybody else. Then we have distribution companies who buy the rights for the movies in those locations. And depending on where you are, they would give you a better deal. So for example, Ireland as a country would get the movies immediately, or the movies and TV series immediately after the US, because they're a smaller nation and there was no risk of it being exposed to anybody else. So they had their own deals, which is why movies used to come out in Ireland before they would be on the BBC, for instance. And they would be on the BBC before they would get translated and put into other countries. So other countries, they don't even have the translations done or the voice prints done or anything. So that's why they would have to be further down the chain. So then businesses start up based around these regions, and then the medium changes. So the businesses are still there, and then they still have a 20-year right to get all the movies from this region, but it doesn't really matter now because everything's digital, but that still doesn't matter because they have the contracts to do it. So, history. Clear? Does that answer the question?
It does. I in my foolish, you know, completely no business sense whatsoever, I would imagine that it would be more beneficial for a company to simply say, oh, we have this fancy new digital distribution thing that we can do. Let's release it to the whole world instantly over the digital network, and people can subscribe to that network and pay us money for the content. Seems obvious.
No, because
to me.
you're making a thing popular in one location, and you're creating
demand.
Demand. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I
get that.
But
sometimes when they know the movie is going to be so atrociously terrible, so all the reviewers hate the movie, what they'll do is, in that case, they will release it in all the regions at the same time in order to get around the fact that people go on to Rotten Tomatoes and places like that. And nobody will go to see it because it's got so many bad reviews. So there is a change afoot in order to do that for movies, to release them on the same day everywhere worldwide, because you can't afford not to get that big bang of opening night everywhere. However, for somewhere like the Switzerland, for instance, where you have multiple languages, each language of the same movie has different licensed distributors for the exact same movie from the exact same studio. So just because you as an engineer would think, well, I'll get this in, the movie in, and I will change the audio track, you know, add three additional audio tracks, and the customer can then pick their audio track, you don't have the rights to do that. So what Netflix do is they will take in their movies, they will add all the audio tracks, they will add all the video, the subtitles, and then they will enable them as soon as the licenses come in.
Yeah, one thing I'd like to add in my experience, now back in the 70s when you had old movies on your TV stations, and I'd actually forgotten this, it would depend on how good the, you know, how old the film was, because back in the 70s you'd be watching this on TV and there would be lines and all that, you know, wear and tear on the film, and you would see that whole thing on the movie, and then things went to DVD and you didn't see that anymore. You know, it's what they mean by remastered. But a few years ago, and this don't have it anymore, this before the fire, the school I did work for had a LaserDisc system, and they eventually threw it out, and the custodians would tell me about these things. Well, maybe you got to grab that. So I did. And first, you know, it came with an educational disc, and I plugged it in, and I had English coming out of one speaker and Spanish coming out of the other. And then I did a little research on the internet. Yeah, for educational stuff, that's what they did. They, you know, to have two languages, they would have the left track being one language and the right track being the other. You only plug in one at a time. So that was interesting. So, you know, I did want to do, you know, watch a movie on it. And I went out on eBay, and wow, these things were expensive. But I didn't grab, like, Lawrence of Arabia, put that in. And the same, you know, same experiences back in the 70s, you wouldn't think. But it came out on LaserDisc. You had all the lines and stuff, you know, no remastering at all. You know, it was just like watching TV 40 years ago.
I find it fascinating. In some countries here in Europe, they dub all the movies. So if you have somebody like Arnold Schwarzenegger, it's dubbed by the same guy the whole time. So if you're new to the industry and you just happen to be lucky and pick somebody who becomes, you know, a multi-million, you know, movie star, then you're lucky as a dubber, because all the work for them, people expect the voice to be the same.
Yeah, that's a pretty good gig.
And I've been waiting for nearly an hour to say welcome to Mongo, and not to be flippant, but when I hear that name, I go back to Blazing Saddles, and all I can think about is Candy Graham for Mongo. Sorry.
And in Poland, to do this interesting thing where instead of dubbing the movie, they have a guy, usually a guy, in a monotone accent doing the whole audio for everybody. So
yeah, that's the worst. My partner is Polish, or part, like, her heritage is Polish, so we have been learning some Polish for fun. And so as part of trying to learn more Polish, we turned on Netflix and went over to the Polish content. And yeah, there are all these movies that say, yes, they're translated to Polish. And it's just this one dude speaking Polish over the soundtrack. So you hear the original soundtrack mixed in with the narrator speaking Polish. It is so confusing. It's horrible. But apparently that's what they like there, because she's complained about it online, and people are like, what's wrong with that?
Nope.
This is great.
We can't get rid of it.
Yeah, Mongo has replied in the in the Mumble chat, said he didn't think about it when he picked the name. He has never seen the movie.
I've seen the movie a long time ago, but I don't remember anything about it, much less that quote. So
groundbreaking at the time. First movie to have flatulence in it.
And Ken Fallon, you were asking about my preference for beers. I have moved on to, I had one left from Free State, a barley wine. Barley wines always win.
Actually, I was asking, do you have a way to track your preferences for beer, not go and have beer 50? You should actually go to bed, my friend.
He happily misunderstood that.
I had a landlord who was banned from having drink by his wife, and when I come up to pay the rent, he would say, will you have a drink? And I'd go, oh, only if you're having one yourself. Oh, man, that was a bad move. Then every month I would have to physically come up and pay the rent, and then 3 hours sitting with him drinking. But that was good.
I really don't see the downside.
Sorry, I'm putting stuff on the scanner as we speak, so hence the delay sometimes. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 people in the chat at the moment.
I'm kind of pondering going to a lunar calendar this year rather than the traditional solar. Has anyone ever used a lunar calendar in real life, or does anyone understand how it works aside from, oh, you track the moon? Like, how does it translate to, like, what's a year in a lunar calendar? It's still got to be judging the Earth's rotation, not the moon's rotation, right, for a year? Or do you just arbitrarily say, this is what a year is in a lunar calendar?
I would imagine this would be different. I don't know.
I've been reading up on the lunar calendars that do exist, but apparently all of them are technically lunisolar calendars. They're not true lunar calendars, probably for that very reason, because you can't really track a year if all you're doing is saying, oh, there's this thing that's rotating around us. You know, what's a year then? You just make it up, I guess. But if I do go to a lunar calendar this year, then my new year technically isn't for another 5 days, because the new moon doesn't happen until January 6th. So I may have celebrated prematurely this afternoon.
I mean, the whole point of a calendar is that you're in sync with other people.
Oh, I was not aware that that was the point.
Well, what's epoch like? We should all switch to epoch and then, yeah, celebrate when it goes to next binary digit or something.
Yeah, okay, I like this.
Well, what is the point of a calendar if it isn't that?
Just something to track your... to sleep by, really. You go to bed when something happens, and then you wake up and you call it a new day. I don't really know what the point of a calendar is, to be honest. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I feel like the current one is... I don't like the month structure right now. I feel like the arbitrary structure of the length of months is really annoying to me, and I think we should all fix that together.
There's an excellent presentation from, we'll call it a presentation from a British comedian where he fixed the calendar properly.
Okay,
I can't remember, but we ended up getting one free day every so often, so yeah, a win there for everybody. So Tuesday always falls on the same day. So if you're born on a Tuesday, it's always a Tuesday. Stuff like that. I'll see if I can get it in the show notes.
Yeah, yeah. Try to dig that up if you can, because that sounds like it's worth listening to. I think I thought I saw Dan. Yeah, Dan S. connected, but he's in the lounge.
Didn't the Mayans kind of figure that out?
Who?
The Mayans?
Probably, but didn't they only go to 2012 or something silly like that? I mean, they need to... Why did they declare an end to their calendar? Or is that just a myth? Did it not really end? They just ran out of stone at that point?
Well, that's a question. I mean, if you're, you know, 1,000 years in the past, you may have thought, yeah, 2012, that's far enough. We get to that point, we'll do it again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I should look into their calendar. I don't know a whole lot about it, really. I've never thought to read up on that. That sounds like it would be an interesting read, though, actually.
So, guys, you may have already talked about this, but did anyone get any decent geeky presents over Christmas?
No, I got myself a new drill.
Actually, no. I can't make it any elaborate than that. No. The thing is, this year, here in the Netherlands, getting presents at Christmas is not a big thing. It's increasing in popularity, but it's not a big thing yet. And we have this other guy. It's at the 5th of December, so a couple of weeks prior to that. And it's called his name is Santa Claus. So that sounds very similar, I know, but it's not Father Christmas. But he's sort of a bishop, and he comes from Spain and not from the North Pole. He doesn't have reindeer, but he has a bunch of helper guys. And
don't mention the war.
Yeah, well, there is this the discussion in our country going on because
democratic discussion, yes.
It's sometimes it's pretty heated. It's a tradition called Black Pete, and so his helper guys are usually these days have a completely black face, and of course, from a colonial perspective, it's kind of loaded. But the other half says it has nothing to do with colonialism, and it's just to and he's black because actually the presents are delivered by going through the chimney, so he gets black. And the other says, "Well, yeah, okay, but then a couple of roots, a couple of smudges on the face would be more realistic." Yeah, but the other guy says, "Then they get very easily recognized by children as, hey, I know you. You are my neighbor or whatever." So you have a group of people who are adamant against this sort of tradition, and equally there is a group of people very adamant in favor of keeping the tradition. And I think about the majority of the population in the Netherlands is in between, as in, okay, let's put up this for discussion. I mean, if somebody gets is offended by the way we do things, let's discuss how we can change this in a way that works for everybody. So but that's of course from a news perspective never interesting. So both the proponents as the contrast or whatever get the equal share of media attention. But anyway, back to the original question, which is, did I get any presents? And the short answer is no. And a little longer answer is that, well, we used to celebrate it with all our children, of course, but then we've got five girls. But by now they're all sort of grown up and have their own celebrations at those days. And my wife and I were contemplating, should we give each other presents? Yeah, but you gave me a present just last week, so I'm good. And we felt the same. So that's the pretty elaborate answer to the no.
Yeah, definitely an elaborate answer.
Yeah, but what would if we didn't do elaborate answer, we would have really, really short podcasts, right?
That's true.
Give it another generation and children will say, chimney, what's that?
Yeah, it's the same with we have this technical museum in the Netherlands, somewhere in the south, and I was there with my kids when they were about 10 and 12, and there was a original part of an original telephone switch with the rotary dials, relays, etc. And they also had a few phones there, also with rotary dials. And there was a number on the wall that you could call another phone a couple of meters away. And they were just picking up the handset. That part went well. And then they were like, okay, how should I dial a number? Because they've never seen anybody use a rotary dial before. It was hilarious. At least that's what I thought. They felt differently. Let's put it like that.
Oh, yeah. You know, we would do pantomime call me, you know, one hand holding the receiver and another, you know, finger rotary thing. And kids these days have no idea what you would mean.
There is actually a hilarious, I think it's on YouTube, but this Ellen DeGeneres, she has this talk show in America. And at some point she did a stand-up comedy performance once. And and she discussed how you would signal another driver in traffic to roll down his windscreen by, you know, rotating with your hand, as in roll down your windscreen. And today, of course, everything is electric. So she would like, I'm sort of trying to get across that I'm pushing a button to roll down the windscreen. It's, well, pretty hilarious to see. And I think something gets lost when I try to explain that here. I have to admit that.
No, I think we all follow you. I mean, the other thing is shifting a manual transmission. That's another thing that's going to be lost to us.
I think there's even a website that sort of collects sounds that are going to disappear, like calling with a rotary phone or a dial tone or a modem, a sound or a steam engine, all those things, all those sounds that are going to go away. And there's sort of a sound museum in a way.
That's a great idea. I like that.
Yeah, I know it exists. I don't know the URL by heart, but I know it's there somewhere.
Speaking of museums, why don't you talk a little bit about your museum, Jeroen, or have you already said everything that you have to say on the podcast?
Well, yeah, I hope I've said everything there is to say. Otherwise, I should make another episode. Well, it's and this is of course something with a sort of broader thing. I think that we are now entering a sort of time period when there actually is computer history that's going to vanish in a short while. I mean, somewhere in the Netherlands, we had in the 50s, I believe, one of the first computers at some R&D lab. I know it's nothing of interest internationally, but just as an example. And the guys making that system then are still alive and sometimes do a talk, but they won't be alive forever. And this is, of course, when we can still capture, and that goes, of course, for other people as well. I mean, you know, Ken Thompson, Dennis Ritchie, Cunningham, whoever, grasp their thoughts and stories for history's sake. So that when in 40, 50 years or so, we all drowned because of global warming, and after 3 million years, they dug everything up. At least they have got nice stories to listen to at the campfire, whatever. But it's the same with, I can't preserve every piece of computing history, but I just got the opportunity to preserve a part of computing history, because this friend of mine, he was cleaning house in a way, and he had been in the AS400 business for, well, since it started, so 1987, 1988. And I actually now have computer tapes with the OS400 1.0 on them. There are three computer tapes. Actually, I got about 2 meters of them if I stack them, but three of those have the original first edition of the operating system. Yeah, and I think that that's something that should be preserved for history. At the same time, I see that IBM these days, although they do great stuff in R&D. I'm not an IBM fan, don't get me wrong, but they do some great R&D stuff. But they, at the same time, and I can understand that because it's a business, they are business and so focused on making a buck and not on preserving their own history in a way. So I've got it now in storage. It's you could say it's a load of stuff. And it's not an exposition, but well, it's a start. And by starting the website, I hope that at some point some people will say, "Hey, I've got an ASRAML system that's going out of production. Hey, there is a museum over there. Let's just ship it to them, and I can preserve it then." So I don't know if it will work, but you know, it's something that I'll try. And let's see what happens.
Yeah, I had a boss at an old job of mine, Bill Von Hagen. And if you go to his website, vonhagen.org, vonhagen.org, he has a computer museum. And I mean, to the point where he had to rent a warehouse to store all of his computers. And it's not just like desktop computers. He would be very selective in what he was archiving, I guess. So he has, you know, I guess DEC computers and VAX probably, those types of systems. And I think he said he had a couple of models of some CPU that did math incorrectly or something. It was some weird buggy CPU back in the 80s maybe. But yeah, it was really interesting to hear him talk about these old systems. And I always, now that I'm not even in the same country as him anymore, I always wish I'd made him take me out to his museum and had a look around.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Yeah. Well, can you spell his name again so I can look him up?
I will paste his site in the little text on the left.
Oh, that works too.
Although looking at his site, it doesn't look like he has a whole lot of information on it. I know he mentions it somewhere on that site. I thought he had more information on that, but maybe not. Maybe I'm just remembering the verbal stories that he passed on to me.
Yeah, my username, if nobody's aware, I'm sure everybody is taken from the original IBM Intel PC. I'm very interested in these, these steps towards that, because I think once the Intel came out, it kind of dominated the market, but, you know, we had all these alternatives included in Europe, the BBC Micro. So, I am in awe and very interested in all the information on these earlier projects.
Yeah, it actually looks like my boss, my old boss, vonhagen.org/collection.html lists all of the systems he currently has in his collection.
Yeah,
a whole lot of it doesn't mean anything to me. Yeah, yeah. I mean, do any of these mean anything? Like, to me, these are just names. I'm sure they're very interesting. But, yeah, it's like Apollo DN, Kato Systems, Altair 8800. Yeah, no idea what any of that means.
Well, I can tell you a little bit about it. So the Apollo, I used to work with Apollo back in the day. That's about 1990-ish. And it was a workstation. It revolved around a 68000 processor. It had the ISA bus, so similar to the PC at that time. And it had a network based on token ring. And every node on the network would have its own unique hexadecimal ID. And just by plugging a node into the network, it would join the network, so you could do, so the CD slash would be the root of your hard disk, but CD slash slash would be the root of your network. So you could do CD slash hexadecimal node ID slash, you would be on the root of another system. Now, there was also, of course, security attached to it. Eh? So it's not like you could do weird stuff, but... it was very easy to run software on another node or visualize stuff on another node, like with X Windows. it had a non-standard keyboard. So it, for instance, it had an edit key. So if you press the edit key, it was graphical. So it would pop up a sort of let's say a notepad like, you know, an ASCII editor, but that, it was a great system. It was bought by HP, who then subsequently buried it because, of course, they wanted to have to gain market share with their own workstations. But it's a shame. And if you look at the systems that he has, so DN100 would be the smallest of them, sort of a single user workstation. If you look at the load, and the 3000 would be the first generation. So after that, the 3010 and the 3500 were subsequent generations of, well, what we these days would call, I guess, a sort of a PC. So it had a keyboard screen and a system unit, and but you could run with more users on that system if you prefer. So yeah, Apollo was great. It's a shame that it got lost. Let's see, what else do you have? Got a Data General desktop generation. Data General, it was back in the 80s. You had this proliferation of computing platforms. Everybody who could solder a piece of RAM and a CPU on a board would suddenly be a hardware supplier, and Data General was one of them. Altair 8800 was, of course, the actually first hobby computer. You had to solder it together yourself in a way, and it used switches on the front to program it. So you didn't have a keyboard, you didn't have a screen, you had a bunch of LEDs and switches, and it had I could be wrong, but a Z80 processor. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong, of course. What else do we have? Well, of course, there's the Apple. Oh wait, you can scroll in the workstation. What else has he got? IBMP and Intergraph. Intergraph, of course, was a workstation. Well, Intergraph was a hardware and software manufacturer, so they made workstations for graphical work, mainly in the computer-aided design and manufacturing world. NextCube was, of course, the NextCube was. Let's say the next burp from what's his name?
But I'm not going to say it.
Yeah, you know what I mean. The guy who ran Apple, Steve Jobs. Yeah, so he was kicked out of Apple and he started his own. He started Next, and at some point he ran back to Apple. Silicon Graphics were, of course, very at that time very heavy graphics systems. You occasionally can still find them on eBay, and then the sort of the Sun systems. A friend of mine in down in Eindhoven, he collects Suns. He used to collect Sun systems, and at some point he got a call from somebody. He said, because he had a web page showing all his Sun stations, Sun workstations, Sun servers, etc. He had a pretty big collection, and at some point he got a email or phone call from a guy somewhere, I believe, in the vicinity in Korea, which is from the Netherlands, pretty far away. And it was like, do you still have this Sun whatever? I said, yeah, I still have it. Okay, can we buy it from you? And he was like, well, if you contact me all the way from Korea, you're probably pretty desperate. So he asked for, I believe he used to say, 20,000 euros, you know, $20,000 in that ballpark. And the other guy said, yeah, sure, no problem. Yeah, excluding, of course, transport. Yeah, of course. And it turned out that somewhere in Korea there was this production facility, and all the production was running on the Sun system, and it was outdated, and it just went up the fritz, I believe they say. So the production was doing nothing because the system was down, and they were pretty desperate and wanted to pay anything to get a replacement in place.
That's pretty brilliant.
Yeah, and after that, Walter Belgers is his name. That's a Dutch guy. Walter Belgers is his name. He just got Last year, he was one of the guys working on the Gigatron. I don't know if you heard of that project. But the Gigatron is... so that's Gigatron. And it... Now, this... Yeah, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't over here. So he got involved in this project called the Gigatron. And it's a 8-bit system with no processor chip, but by discrete components. So 7800 series of chips on them. And it even does audio and RGB VGA, I believe. So it's hilarious to have a look at it. Anyway, back to the list. Apples, of course. Soviet computers I know nothing about. Way cool peripherals. Nope. Doesn't ring a bell. Oh, teletype. He's got teletypes. That's pretty cool. Of course, you know that teletype is the basis of Unix, and that's why TTY is a TTY command. So, well, that's my small burp of knowledge on his list of stuff he collected. And I give the phone back to somebody else, because I've been talking way too long.
It's Tony's turn to talk about tnmoc.org. Have you been there?
Sorry, no, I haven't.
I was at MIT a couple years ago now, and I went down to there on the lower floor of MIT. They have a sort of a, I don't remember if it's a full-blown museum or if it's just a makeshift museum of where they put old stuff, but they had some Lisp machines downstairs that I got to see. That was really cool to see an actual, just a Lisp machine. It was just like this rack of components. Very cool to see.
Yeah, the Museum of Computing that we've got here, the one that I put the link in the chat, was the base for the decoders of the encryption machine during the Second World War. I can't remember. Ken will probably be able to remember what it's called.
But Enigma.
That's it, Enigma. And they brought together
The hacking system itself was called Colossus.
That's correct, yeah. But they brought together a team which was including Alan Turing, which a lot of people will have heard of. They made a movie about him recently. And they eventually cracked the Enigma code. But they've now turned that into the computing museum for this country. And there's all sorts of cool stuff there, including the Colossus is still there, although it's under wraps at the moment because they're having problems with the roof.
That's very cool. That would be really neat to see.
As a small addition to this, I believe the site is called Bletchley Park, and if you go out to Bletchley Park and to the left and to the back of it, there's a small entrance there where there's sort of the hobby club of people who used to work at the museum, and they have another load of hardware that they like to show off and run for you. So if you go to that museum, which is of course something that you have to do once, I don't get me wrong, never been there, but really want to, and after that go to the back and do it another more round. Well, that's it for now.
Yeah, it's definitely on my bucket list.
And I also, somewhere in the south of Germany, I believe, are also computer museums that are really worth to look at. That's because I know one of the guys in the Netherlands who started to work with the first release of Unix back in the day, and he's still alive, he's 68 now, I believe. And he... travel to a few museums, so I can hardly just buy if he endorses something. I just know it's good, so I'll look it up and paste it in the channel notes from in a few moments.
That's cool. So has anyone got any shows planned for 2019 that they're able to talk about?
I am hoping to get back to my admin series, which I'd started last year, think and sort of fell off from. I want to cover setting up. I think I already did a VPN setup, but yeah, there are a couple of topics that I still think basic sysadmin stuff would be useful to know about. So I want to go over some things in detail. That's pretty much all I have planned for this coming year, though. I think more stuff will arise.
Yeah, I'm hoping to go to a few geek events, Liverpool Make Fest again, and hopefully the 10th anniversary of OggCamp in October. Ken, nice. You coming?
I think Ken stepped away earlier.
Ah, right. He snuck
had to go
off.
To chores. Yeah.
Right. But yeah, Ken, you. I first met Ken at OggCamp several years ago. And he got me to do an interview, and it took me another 3 or 4 years before I got around to doing my first show for HPR.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's funny how things sometimes work out. I mean, I was at OggCamp this year for the first time, and somebody approached me and said, "Well, can you make a podcast of your talk?" So that. Now, I know what a podcast was, but there was never really any interest or never did anything with it. But then I made my first podcast, and you get a few, and then you get your first feedback. Now, if you do your first podcast and you're, you know, a little self-aware about it, and then the first comment starts with, "Now this is embarrassing," it's not really what you're looking for at that particular point in time. But it turns out he was embarrassed because he had been thinking about doing this talk for years, and I just beat him to it, just by accident, I guess. So having done one, I thought, well, do I want to make another one? Yeah, why not? It's sort of it's a way to do a brain dump, I guess, for prosperity's sake, or I don't know why. I just started. Recording podcasts on a sort of approximately on a monthly basis for the things I've been doing the last few years. And at some point in time, I will probably come to a halt because, well, there's nothing more for me to talk about. Having said that, yes, to answer Klaatu's question, if I have ideas, yeah, well, my idea for my next podcast is I've been a volunteer firefighter for 10 years and I stopped 5 years ago because I'm now 55 and I was feeling getting too old to do this, but I think I can share a lot of knowledge about what it entails to be a firefighter, because there's a lot to it, and again, make a brain dump of that, and beyond that, I really have no idea. The other thing is, although I want to do it on a monthly basis, so that would probably be half of January, I'm challenged to do that because on the 1st of February we get the keys to another house, so we are pretty busy packing up the house, or how, I don't know how you call it in English, but anyway, getting set to relocate.
Getting the removal men in.
Sorry, what's that?
In this country, we call it getting the removal men in and packing up and getting the removal van to come and move your gear to the new house.
Okay, the removal man. Yeah, sure. I got a quotation the other day, and since it's only 2 kilometers drive from this to the other house, I think I'll just do it myself.
That's okay then. Talking about how you got into doing the podcast, and you mentioned that it was your first talk at OggCamp. I did my first bar camp talk the other way around. I ended up doing my first bar camp talk about Hacker Public Radio at Manchester Bar Camp a few years ago. It was a way of talking about something I knew about, and B, it was my introduction to Bar Camp, being a Bar Camp presenter. I'd never done it before.
So Bar Camp, is that what I think it's about?
Bar Camp's just an unconference they just call it a bar camp, whereas Og Camp is an unconference with a track that's fixed, and they've got guest speakers that are already programmed in. So yeah, most bar camps are unprogrammed completely.
I think bar camp is as opposed to foo camp. Is that, do you know if that's correct, Tony? There's such a thing as a foo camp, right? Or am I just making that up?
I don't know what that is, so I couldn't answer that.
Yeah, probably it's that. That would, yeah, I'm probably, too bad. I mean, I prefer bar camp as in, you know, drinks and bar, but yeah, probably it's related to foo.
Oh, usually if you go to these events, when the actual talks are finished, there's usually a little bit of drinking goes on.
Yeah, it was the same at Och Camp, and I must say that it was very nice to attend the social gatherings and talk to people and share a beer and a few stories. It was an excellent good time.
Yeah, Og Camp's particularly good. I've been there a few years, but I haven't managed to make it for the last couple of years.
It's almost 3 a.m., so I'm going to head off and get some sleep. Happy New Year to everybody and whoever's up next on the New Year list, someplace in the middle of the Pacific, I guess.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you, Klaatu, and thanks for joining us.
Yep, my pleasure. Talk to you guys later.
Wow, you're actually 12 hours ahead of me. It's incredible. Okay, have a nice sleep.
And cool.
Nice talking to you.
Yeah, nice meeting you in voice person. All of you.
Yeah, okay. Cheers, Klaatu. So are we the only ones around at the moment, Jerome?
I think we are.
This is a bit strange because I was on my podcast last night. I don't know if you listen to Mintcast.
Not yet. I don't think so. Is there a URL I can look at?
If you go to mintcast.org, it's a podcast that got started 10 years ago about Linux Mint, but it's now Linux Mint and all about other Linux as well. So, you know, we entitled it a podcast for the Linux Mint community and all users of Linux.
Oh yeah, found it. Yeah, it's funny how these things work. You know, So in August I was at Och Camp. I liked it. I did a podcast by request. I got interested in podcast. I installed a podcast app on my phone. I subscribed to a few RSS channels, and a few weeks later I had to drive for 8 straight hours. Well, not straight, you know, but with 2 hours interrupts. But I had a long drive ahead of me, and I put on the podcast, any podcast, and it's so relaxed when you drive to have no ads. Well, sometimes you have a podcast with a few ads, but not really irritating ones mostly, and it's so relaxed, and the hours just flew by. So since then, whenever I go drive in my car alone, it's podcast time.
Yeah, I used to do that. I used to, before I retired, I used to commute to work, and it was about a 45-minute commute. So I'd stick a podcast on the way to work and on the way home from work, and that was how I managed to get through most of my podcast list.
Yeah, exactly. That works brilliantly. Okay. So when we're just the two of us, what do you currently think of the? Well, I know it's a loaded question, but I won't judge. But I'm just curious. What do you think of the Brexit at the moment?
Ooh, politics. Is this a good rabbit hole to go down? Let's just say I'm not a big fan of it. And they're making even though we've agreed, the country narrowly, very narrowly voted for it, the government seem to be making a right hash of it all.
Yeah, okay.
But my personal choice would be to stay with the status quo and leave us where we are.
Yeah, like you said, it's of course it's a rabbit hole, and with inter what's the word for it? Intercultural exchanges like we are doing now, it's always best to avoid politics and religion. So, but at the same time, I'm curious about how is it perceived by people living in the UK, because I'm clearly not. But and I have my opinion, of course. But I'm also interested in what other people think of it. When I was in Sheffield, I stayed in an Airbnb, and in the Airbnb there was this woman staying. She was an accountant, and I asked her, of course, how do you think about this Brexit? And she was adamant about leaving, and because her argument was that she had a few grandchildren, and in a couple of years' time, the original English people would be a minority. That's what she said, and that's how she believed it. And clearly, she was very emotional about it. So I asked her, how many people are there in the UK? Because I know how many people are living in the Netherlands, but I don't know it of every country. And she said something like 60 million. And I asked her, how many people do you need to add to that from another country before you feel that it's that you are becoming a minority? And somehow she never thought of it that way. So it was really, but she was really emotional about it. I don't know how to, I don't know how to really respond to that other than seeing somebody being emotional about it, and that does something to me. But I'm rambling on, and it doesn't seem to be a point anywhere in sight, so I'll just shut up for the moment.
I have a question for you too.
Sure.
Was it you, Tony, who said, or no, or was it you, Jerome, who said, tempting the fates of bringing politics and religion up? Who said that? Was that you, Jerome?
Can you repeat that?
Who said about tempting the fate of bringing politics and religion up?
I think I mentioned that it was quite a rabbit hole to go down.
Yeah. Okay. So this is something I've been bantering around with my wife for some time. That thought of politics and religion being rabbit holes and makes for uncomfortable situations. And you're always told to stay away from those, particularly in mixed groups and company. But yet, at the same time, if we don't bring those subjects up in mixed groups and companies, we end up in a situation where we have very little say in a public forum on those topics, which immensely impact our world around us. Without challenging that and being uncomfortable initially in those situations, because they do bring up heated debates and boil the blood, we can't get to a more centrist place where we can look at what we agree and what we disagree with, challenge ourselves on what we disagree with, and come to a more hopefully informed opinion. Otherwise, we just end up in echo chambers, not discussing this with the people around us, particularly our neighbors and family, and become surprised at life-changing, world-changing events like Brexit, or you pick the topic that's going on right now in the world, and it's ugly on TV, but nobody wants to address it where it really counts, at the community level or in your backyard.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you there. I've got a really good friend who has got the totally opposite standpoint for me about Brexit, and he was totally in favour of it. And we argued before the the actual vote, there was a lot of stuff going around on social media, and we'd argue the point on a particular thing he might have posted, and I'd argue my opinion on it and stuff like that. Luckily, we've managed to stay friends, but I think we are where we are with it as far as the Brexit vote goes. My problem with it now is not the people who voted for it or against it or whatever. It's the hash that the actual politicians are making of it.
Well, it's to get back for a moment to I had to answer somebody here for a minute. I find myself that I can ask people things about difficult subjects like religion or like politics by putting foremost the fact that I respect people for what they are as a person, and I have my opinion, but my first thing is that I'm curious about what makes the other tick, and why does another person think the way they think, and by listening to them, sort of enriching me in a way, you know, by listening to other viewpoints. And I think so that yes, I agree that if you say some subjects should not be discussed, like politics or religion, you get into a silo and you look up the people that think similar to you. But if we could put our respect for the other one first and say, look, I'm thinking that you are a reasonable human being, and maybe misguided. That can happen. You know, people sometimes make a decision or make a viewpoint based on the data that they have, but the data that they have doesn't need to be accurate or anything else. But if my first, my basis of the communication is respect for the other, and then we start a discussion and listen to them, and maybe the other one does the same to me, and I can fill in the blanks where there are any, or we can just agree to disagree, you know, as in, okay, for me, some viewpoint is different from the viewpoint of my opponent, but he bases his on because he values certain principle differently than I do, for instance. And then you can, I think, agree to disagree with keeping a mutual respect. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I've got to come clean. I come from a family that was migrants to the UK at the beginning of the 20th century. So I'm only second, third generation on my mother's side. But if you go to many places in the world, the predominant population actually weren't the original natives of that country. If you go to Australia, America, Canada, the predominant population is European, but the Native Americans and Canadians and Australians have still lived there, but they've been shunted into the corner.
Yeah. That's what they call colonialism, I believe. And it's the fact that they, as I gather, the fact that they told themselves that this was a tolerable behavior was based actually on the Origins of Species by Darwin, saying, okay, if I can conquer your world, then my species is superior to yours, and survival of the fittest, you lose. So and that's how they did a lot of this in the colonialism time or period to rectify their behavior.
Yeah, there's a lot of that, but it's a massive topic that you can, like you say, when you want to discuss it, if you can have a rational discussion and agree sometimes to disagree, that's fine. But there's been so many cases where that discussion has turned into violent conflict, both in this country and other places in the world. It's it just beggars belief sometimes.
Yeah, I understand it. Just another thing, I have my dog here, and he is standing next to me with his legs crossed. That's what we say when he really needs to go. So I'm hopping off the channel for some time and walking the dog. Right, I'll be back.
I'll nip out and go and get myself something to eat, and I'll come back later on.
Well, it was nice talking to you and nice listening to you.
Sorry, Dan.
Yeah,
I did have one question for you, Tony. Was Joe on the show last night?
Do you mean Joe Ressington?
No.
The other Joe? Yeah, the one of the new crew.
The Joe from Texas?
Yeah, he was there.
Oh, that bastard.
What's that about?
He goes on a lot of shows, right? And he talks about some really, really good stuff. He brings a lot of great stuff. But the problem is, he never brings it to our show.
What's your show?
The Linux Link Tech Show. So
he might be around tonight, because I know you're planning to have a bit of a group meetup around 2 o'clock Eastern Time, aren't you? On this channel.
I hope so. I got to go help my wife move some stuff out of her business into another location in her business. But I hope to. Yeah. So hopefully, yeah. He's a good guy, though. I like Joe.
I was planning to join in on that, so I might see you around again later.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
Talk to you later. Cheers.
And that's it. Hey, everybody's gone.
Hey, this is Mongo. I'm still here. I just couldn't get my thing figured out. I don't use Mumble very often, so took me a while to get started.
Sorry, Mongo.
I don't know what happened, Mongo, but you sound a heck of a lot better than 5150 did.
Well, I don't know what I sound like, but I wasn't able to figure out how to set up a push to talk.
You got it now, right?
5150 sounded like he was coming from across a cavernous room.
Yeah, I think 50's microphone's in like Missouri, and he's in Kansas, so I don't know what's going on.
Right, I'm off for something to eat, and I'll see you guys later.
All right, 50, go ahead. What's that, 50?
I'm on a faster network than I ever have been.
Can you like turn your mic up a little bit?
Maybe that's just redshift.
Cause you're very faint, 50.
How's that?
It's getting a little better. Crank that pulse out of your right
tab, just a second. How's that?
It's getting better all the time. Now I can actually hear you.
Well, that's max.
There we go. That's good. Before it was like really hard to hear you.
Well, it's a new ISP.
Who's your ISP?
Oh, it's going to sound weird. Blazing Hog?
Glazing or Blazing?
Blazing.
Oh, okay. That sounds better than Glazing.
If you look it up on Google, you're going to come up with a bunch of barbecue sites.
So are they local?
No, I think they're pretty much national. It's over the wireless network, cellular tech.
I hate it when a company only has a Facebook page.
Yeah. No, if you go to that made me a little suspicious, but they have a link there. It's blazinghog.com.
Oh, okay.
Neighbor of mine had it. You know, I am. Trying it out. I am not backing it yet because it's a lot slower than what they promised. But my neighbors did have to get additional antennas and plug it into their cellular modem. So I'll go that far, and then if I don't get any speed, I will say, yeah, it's not a good deal.
Are you rural?
Very.
Yeah, that's my wife and I are looking to figure out if we want to move. And every time we look at a place, I go out and check to see what's the internet like, because we're in the city, and of course we have pretty decent cable internet service, and we've got some friends who do the mobile phone conversion that costs a fortune and is crap once even when it works, you know. And we don't want, I don't want to ever be in that situation.
Yeah, I had like a Wi-Fi, but for my last provider, they guaranteed like 3. Sometimes they would jump up to 6, and a lot of times it was like 1 megabit down or less. You know, I was always having to unplug the uplink and plug it back in, and then seeing what I got.
Yeah, it's been a long time since that kind of speeds were necessary for most people.
Yeah, since I've gone to this, I'm getting like 4.6. But like I said, my neighbors, they had to go on Amazon, buy extra antennas, get into the modem. I was hoping, I was like a mile from, not even a quarter mile from, the wireless uplink on the local elevator. I was thinking, yeah, hopefully I won't have to buy any other equipment, but looks like I'm going to have to.
Yeah, sounds like it.
And I think all the Europeans have dropped off. Kind of, you know, we talk about Brexit. Of course, we're not British, but, you know, being Americans, being independent, we're kind of suspicious of any sort of government beyond our own. So we kind of understand the Brexit thing, or at least the Conservatives do. I'm sorry, I won't say the whole country, but I certainly understand the, you know, the why people would have voted for Brexit.
Well, I certainly understand the feeling of it. I think the in the United States, we've got the you know, we're sovereign, and we don't feel like the European countries, individual countries, are sovereign because they have the European Union over them and the European Court, and it kind of makes us feel a little creepy. But so we certainly understand it. It's just, I guess, history will tell us how this is going to work out. It doesn't look pretty right now. But I certainly understand the why it got started.
Well, I can see, you know, from every aspect, looking at it economically, it does not look like a good idea.
Oh, it's going to hurt for a while. I have British stock too. It's that's just in the tank, and I'm going, oh man.
Well, yeah, my ancestors were all Scottish, which today, they see more towards the left side. I would really, you know, on my bucket list is to go over there and, you know, trod the old sod as it would be. But probably my politics would not be popular.
Well, when I said stock, I didn't mean my genetic makeup, which does include some, of course, it's European. But I meant stock market.
Oh, okay.
I own some British utility stock that I thought was going to be, you know, have a little bit of a nice dividend plus a slow increase in value over the time for my retirement, and that it would look pretty good in my portfolio. As soon as I, you know, about, I don't know, 6 months or a year after I bought this stock, they start talking Brexit, and okay, it's, I don't know how far it's off now from where I bought it, but with the even the dividends aren't worth anything now because the money exchange thing has gotten worse, and the stock, you can't just like sell the stock because now I'm down 15 or 20% probably at least, and it's like, oh, I guess I get to keep it.
Yeah, I always say I'm an idiot when I didn't put every dollar I had into Bitcoin when it's like $4,
or Apple, or Xerox or Harley Davidson or definitely Google or Netflix.
Oh, definitely I should have bought Google. And I know in college I should have bought Intel and IBM.
It's funny, I've never owned, well, let's see, if I own Google stock, maybe for a short time, I don't remember. I think I did own Google stock for a while, but back when Google was young and I was using something that was, you know, much older my brother-in-law and then his son were all talking about, hey, this new Google thing, it really works a lot better than my old, AltaVista is what I used. And my wife's going, well, you should buy some stock. Of course, none of us did ever.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.